My name is Larry Galizio, and it is Wednesday, February 21st, 2007, and this is the Joint Ways and Means Subcommittee on Education, and we're really excited that we have such a good turnout today. This afternoon, we just had a wonderful tour of Lincoln and some of the science buildings and innards, and it was fascinating and very useful. So today, just to kind of briefly to give a little bit of an overview, very shortly I'm going to ask each of the members of the committee to introduce themselves. And today, we want to do several things, but we have the opportunity. First, we're going to have President Bernstein give a PSU welcome, which we're really appreciative of, and Portland City Commissioner Sam Adams has gotten off of the tram and safely, and so he's here. I was excited to see that. And then James Sager, who's the governor's education and workforce policy advisor, is going to give a presentation about the governor's education enterprise. And although we're the education subcommittee, and our job is really to comb through the education budgets from K through higher ed, thus far we've been hearing a lot of budgets health-related, and it's kind of a logistical reason that we do that. There are so many budgets. But this is sort of our kickoff, really, to start talking about the education budgets. So we thought this would provide a wonderful forum for us to start the discussion, kindergarten through higher ed. Today, Mr. Sager is going to give, again, the kind of a big picture look at the governor's approach to education. And so I think that's going to be really useful. And then, importantly, we'll have some student perspectives on the education enterprise. And then we have my boss, Preston Pulliams from Portland Community College, Sylvania, and Dr. Bernstein to talk about some of the partnerships that take place among the community colleges and community colleges are also degree-granting university. I don't even say four-year schools anymore because that's becoming almost a minority. But between community colleges and PCC or PSU and OSU and other colleges. And then we're going to have an alumni perspective and then a business perspective. And then we're going to open it up for public testimony and would encourage any of you that have questions, comments, observations. We are obviously a public body, and we're here to listen to all of you, the public. And so you want to talk about education and you hear something that's of interest to you and you want to comment on or ask us questions, that's what we're here for. So, again, thank you very much. And why don't I turn it over? I'm going to, if we could start from the left end of the table, and I'm going to ask each of the committee members to briefly introduce themselves. So, Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm State Representative David Edwards. I represent House District 30. Which is Greater Hillsboro, North Plains, and Roy and Verbort outside Cornelius and Forest Grove in Washington County.
And I'm State Representative Bob Jensen. I represent House District 58, which is mostly Umatilla County, most of Umatilla County.
Yeah, I'm State Rep Susan Morgan, and I represent House District 2, which is the south central part of Douglas County and portions of Josephine and Jackson counties.
I'm Larry Galizio, House District 35, and that is the city of Tigard, and it includes a bit of Multnomah County, actually Portland Community College, Sylvania area, and unincorporated Bull Mountain and King City. Well, I want to introduce you special, but we're just keep,
Senator Richard Devlin, Senate District 19, Lake Oswego, West Lynn, Tualatin, Lower Southwest Portland, and PSU graduate 76.
I'm Vicki Walker. I'm from Senate District 7 in Eugene and Junction City. I'm a University of Oregon graduate, 1978, and I'm also chair of the Senate Education and General Government Committee.
78. You went to college when you were 8, right?
I just have preserved well.
Yes. Okay. And I want to introduce, and I want you to say anything. This is Steve Bender. We're very fortunate in the Capitol. We have a legislative fiscal office, and we have legislative fiscal analysts who are the folks that, just amazing. There is institutional history, and they have incredible knowledge of what's happened in the past in terms of budgets, and they provide us with information so that hopefully we can make well-informed decisions. So this is Steve Bender, and if you have anything that you'd like to say in terms of this.
Well, I'm the staff in the Legislative Fiscal Office for the post-secondary education budgets. So we work with the Ways and Means on those budgets.
So. Well, again, thank you very much, all of you, for being here. And now I'm going to turn it over to Dan Bernstein, who I think has a couple of words. And I told Dr. Bernstein that I was actually not available to coach the PSU football team, but would entertain any offers.
Well, thank you very much, Chair Galizio, members of the committee. I am Dan Bernstein, president of PSU. And I'm certainly willing to take your suggestions for football coach. I've been getting quite a few lately. But I want to thank all of you for making this special effort to leave the Capitol and to come to Portland State. I think it's very important, and we are glad that you took the time to be here and to tour some of our facilities. Many of you already have connections to PSU as students, parents of students, alumni, and we appreciate the fact that you have those connections to our university. As you know, we are Portland's urban university with over 25,000 students, and we take our urban mission very seriously. And in some respects, the fact that you're sitting in this building is kind of symbolic of what we are as an institution. It's the home of our College of Urban and Public Affairs, which is one of the top colleges of that discipline in the country. This site with a streetcar running through the plaza, we were one of the major contributors to the streetcar. We wanted to ensure that it stopped on our campus. The building across the way is what we call the PCAT building, and it will soon be the home of our Student Rec Center, which will be another major addition to our campus. And as we had talked about during the testimony, we're trying to coordinate our construction of that rec center with the light rail construction so that we don't disrupt this block more than once. And so in many respects, what you're sitting at is the front door to our campus, and we're excited that every form of public transportation passes through PSU. In other words, all roads lead to Portland State University. I just want to talk briefly about a couple of things that are also important to our mission. First is our University Studies program, which is our undergraduate curriculum, and we've received national and international recognition for that program. We've had over 350 universities from around the world come to see what we're doing in undergraduate education. And despite the fact that we have a university of over 25,000 students, in terms of our undergraduate curriculum, we really do provide our students with a much smaller liberal arts experience. Our students study across disciplines. They are required to work in small groups. And as a requirement for graduation, they must produce a work product. We call it a capstone project. And it's a product that's more than make work. It's actually a product that contributes to an institution, either nonprofit and even for-profit institution. And it requires our students to work across disciplines. And because we're also the most diverse university in the state, they're working with students from other backgrounds and experiences. And in many respects, what we're trying to do is duplicate the work environment for our students. And because most working environments are now global as opposed to local, what we think we offer for our students is something that they can take away with them and be good citizens and good employers in the future. Sustainability is also another important part of what we do at PSU, and sustainability crosses our curriculum, but it also is involved. It also crosses what we do in terms of construction of our building and our practices around around the campus. Our new engineering building just received a gold LEED certification, and all of our all the facilities that we'll be constructing will certainly have at least silver, if not gold or platinum, LEED certifications. As you know, with our facilities, we have multi-purpose buildings with the ground floor being retail, academic space on the upper floors, and so on. What we're trying to do is build a not only a university, but also build a neighborhood, because we see ourselves as kind of the major contributor to the development of the south end of downtown Portland. And then finally, on in front of you, I think you have a copy of an economic impact statement that we just completed a few months ago, and it shows that PSU contributes over $1 billion to the metropolitan region, and so you should be proud of the investment, of the return on your investment in terms of what you provide and what we provide in terms of the quality of life of the region, but also the economic impact of the region. I certainly could go on and on, but I know that every minute I take, I have to yield to Preston Pulliam so he can talk about PCC. So, and I know you also have a very long agenda, but again, I know that's an extraordinary effort on your part to be here, but I also want to congratulate you on making the effort, and I think the fact that there's so many people here is a testament to the importance of your actually leaving Salem and getting out into the community, and we're happy to be a host for today's hearing. So again, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you very much, President Bernstein. And one thing on that football coach: as long as you don't take away Jeff Tedford from my alma mater, and I think yours too, that would be everyone else's would be fine.
I agree. That's my alma mater.
All right, there we go. Okay.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much. All right, now I'd like to invite Portland City Commissioner Sam Adams, who there he is, who has some remarks, and appreciate the fact that you could come today. Good to see you.
Good to be here. I just came back from Salem, lobbying some of your colleagues on issues related to the city's sewer system. In addition to being transportation commissioner and the liaison to higher education, I'm also the sewer commissioner for the city of Portland. You can imagine how proud my parents are to introduce me at gatherings as the city sewer commissioner. But I am Sam Adams, Portland city commissioner, and I too want to join President Bernstein. And I know President Pulliam in thanking you for making the outreach and coming here to Portland. It's a big state, and the fact that you're taking this on the road, you're to be commended. Things are moving very fast down in Salem, and I also want to thank you for that and commend you for that. The efficiency in which things are getting done is really impressive. Also want to thank you, Mr. Chair, for making higher education a higher visible priority for the state legislature and your work with the governor's office on the issue of higher education funding is much appreciated. Higher education here in the city of Portland, as you heard just from PSU president and you'll hear from PCC president, higher education, the industry of higher education here in the city of Portland is our number one industry. It employs over 40,000 people in the city of Portland and has a $2 billion annual payroll. Say that again, 40,000 people, $2 billion annual payroll. That's not the multiplier, that is just the payroll. So we hear from our citizens the message clearly and often that you need an advanced education and or training to earn a living wage and have employment security. And you all know, much of the public knows that's true, but Portland's economic security and the Portland region's economic security and the state as a whole is also secured in many ways by the success of our education. I'm going to touch upon an issue as the Portland City Council's first higher education advocate. I want to touch upon the issue of tuition at universities. But before I do that, you know, just want to make a pitch for the funding support request asked for by the community colleges. And as you saw on your tour, the needs of PSU with Lincoln Hall, Science B building, the PCAT building, which is across the way here that has not yet made it into the budget. These are all projects that are key to PSU's, the region's, and the state's success. The city of Portland, under my previous boss, Mayor Bear Katz, was the first mayor to invest cold hard cash into PSU. And we have, I think, about $12 million invested into various PSU facilities here that have been partnered with state money. So the emphasis of higher education and our success as a city, we put our some money where our mouth is, and we intend to do more. In the last decade, turning to the issue of tuition, tuition at universities has risen, as you know, about 67% at community college and has climbed 94% at universities. The average debt load for students graduating from college is now $20,000. In 2006-07, the maximum Oregon Opportunity Grants ranged between averages of $1,400 for community colleges and $1,600 at public universities, and between $2,100 and $4,600 at universities and colleges. Sorry. In the last session, there was an important increase made in the Oregon Opportunity Grant funds. Nonetheless, the grants have not kept pace with inflation. My last fact, the cutoff line for students living with their families to qualify for a grant topped out at $33,100 for a family of four. A family earning $34,000 a year could not qualify. Senate Bill 334, the Oregon Shared Responsibility Grants Bill, will change the top-off level for qualification to almost $61,000 for a family of four. And this is, I believe, a much more realistic level. And the bill, along with the budget levels being proposed by Governor Kulongowski, will almost double the numbers of students receiving grants from 24,000 to an estimated 42,000. So on behalf of the City of Portland, I welcome you here again. I commend you for your work, the work of the Ways and Means Education Subcommittee. I strongly applaud your very visible effort at bringing more support to higher education, and hope that you have a very good hearing and a very good stay here in the City of Portland. Spend lots of money. And stay out of jail, of course.
Thank you, Commissioner
Always
Adams. Does anyone have any questions? Or okay.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. Good to see you. Appreciate it. All right, now I'd like to call up Mr. James Sager, who is the Governor Kulongoski's Education and Workforce Policy Advisor, and we've given Mr. Sager, I think, 20 minutes. Is that what I told you?
That's what you told me.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
And, again, for our purposes, this is the first time, the committee's probably heard bits and pieces, but it's an opportunity, I think, for all of you to give, you know, kind of big picture. What's the governor's education enterprise? What's it about? What does it mean? And so, with that, Mr. Sager.
Chair Glazio, members of the committee, for the record, James Sager with the governor's office. First of all, thank you for giving me this opportunity, even though I may be talking very quickly, trying to cover all the material in 20 minutes. Margie Lau, who works with me in the office, has done a yeoman's job of helping me try to condense a couple hours worth of comments into 20 minutes. I, too, want to, though, just take a minute to thank Portland State for letting us meet here. Also being an alum of Portland State and wearing my official image badge, I think it's called. I just want to give kudos to them for having us here today. As you know, over the past several years, the governor has been emphasizing that we need to end the kind of bifurcated look that we've had at education, where we segment pre-kindergarten, K-12, community college, university, OHSU, and all the kind of integral pieces of that into these silos, and they end up competing against each other rather than working collaboratively. And so he has given us the direction, us meaning both myself and the boards of education, to really look at how we unify the sectors of education into a single enterprise, and we coordinate not only programs but budget. And so as I go through the presentation today, I want to give you a little sense of the work, especially over the last 18 to 24 months, that If you think back 2 years ago, before the legislative session, so a little over 2 years ago, it was the first time that representatives from each of the sectors actually sat down in a room together and talked about how we budget inside each sector. It just wasn't the way we operate. Since then, we've made real strides, again, with the working group from the Joint Boards of Education, looking at how we align the program, but then also how program then should drive budget and should drive those decisions. So the governor asked us, and I'm flipping very quickly through my high-tech PowerPoint presentation here. The governor asked us to look out to the year 2025 and ask ourselves, what is Oregon going to need as far as an educated populace? And we started looking at those Oregonians who are currently age 2 to 42, because by 2025, that is going to be the primary workforce, 20 to age 60 in the state of Oregon. And so we had to look at what are those needs and how can we begin to build the infrastructure that's going to be needed in order to meet those demands. We were looking at the changing population. I mean, the Latino Hispanic community in Oregon is the fastest growing community. If they have English as second language issues, they deserve the access and the training in order to help them get the skill sets that they need to be successful, whether they're in a K-12 setting or they're an adult worker in the setting. So we have to look at the changing demographics. We have to ask ourselves what kind of educational staff and facilities are going to be needed inside that. And then how can we, again, align those programs so that our decisions around the budget are being driven by the programs that we think are needed to lay in place over that period of time. So that we have kind of a graphic that we put together that lays out the education enterprise in a single sheet of paper. Again, that the goal of the enterprise, or the mission of the enterprise, to ensure that Oregonians possess the knowledge and skills necessary to succeed in learning, work, and citizenship in Oregon and the global economy. So again, we can't just look at, you know, are we preparing traditional students to make it into higher ed, or at-risk students. We have to look at the whole spectrum, and especially our current adult workforce, because they're actually the largest segment of people that will impact Oregon economy, and look at how that translates then into Oregon's position in the global economy. We set out a series of five enterprise goals that I'll go into a little more detail in a minute, and try to show you the breadth of collaboration and coordination between all the sectors of the enterprise, including the workforce training component, which traditionally, again, has not been viewed. And this is all kind of built upon putting together a stable and adequate funding system, which is also part of the governor's plan. So we start off by identifying, and I believe that your sheets ended up back-to-back at this page, but the first long chart that you have shows we first asked all the agencies as the traditional starting point after we'd had all these conversations around how we are going to coordinate programs and things. So what are your budget requests going to be? We had 68 different policy packages equaling over $2 billion. So we had a lot of requests, and we needed to review these across the sectors. And working with the Joint Boards of Education, we created four criteria to kind of put these into some sort of structure. And the four criteria were looking at cross-sector infrastructure proposals. So what are things that, again, cross-sector we need as far as the infrastructure, cross-sector program and service initiatives, so that we're not funding one piece of the system here, but then we're missing the next step in the continuum, service-specific programs, and then sector stabilization needs. So we categorized all of those, all the requests, and so the second sheet is slightly different from the first as far as the list, where we show that how we divided these up and then prioritized them inside those four categories. So the way it worked out, the packages sorted out, we had seven different proposals that were this cross-sector infrastructure, about 28 proposals that were this coordinated program view. Sector-specific programs were 37, worth almost $1.8 billion. I need to emphasize that $1 billion of those requests are the capital construction requests that came in from community colleges and the university, So that is where Lincoln Hall and the science building and things are included in the proposal. So again, we sorted by this so that we could begin the process of making sure that we're focusing on the right elements as we try to sort this down to include in the governor's budget. So within each of those areas, our first concern was stability. You know, we can talk about adding new programs and expanding opportunity, but if at the same time we are overtaxing the system that we have, we don't have the physical capacity, we don't have the class offerings, we don't have the faculty members, and we don't have teachers ready to do the work we're asking of them, it doesn't make much sense. So we made sure that as we went through these, we looked at providing that stability to the system throughout pre-K 20. We then looked at how we link the programs across the system. Again, a great deal of work, and some of you have seen the report on Senate Bill 342, which was the alignment of curriculum between community college and university. I think I got that number right, 345. Anyway.
It was 342. 342,
that's what I was thinking, yes. And so, again, we wanted to make sure that the programs, that the budgets were there to drive those programs of alignment, to remove the barriers for students programmatically supported by the budget as we push those through. And we wanted to make sure that we maintain balance and fairness. That is, the governor was tired of the fact that at the end of the legislative session, instead of everyone feeling good because education benefited, it was a conversation, well, who are the winners and losers inside of education? When that becomes a conversation, the system loses. And so the governor was very focused on making sure that we are not only supporting the entire system, but we're making strategic investments throughout so that, in fact, we have that alignment and we have that growth. The of the original 68 proposals, 54 of the proposals were funded, and it came to about $1.3 billion of proposals. Again, a large portion of that was the capital construction budget that we put forward. But again, as we looked at the items that finally made into the governor's budget, we not only looked at this biennium, but we asked ourselves, so what are programs that even if we put the money in right away for this coming fall, which would be the first year of the biennium, would the education system be able to implement the program? And if the answer was no, then we said, well, then let's plan to start that in the 08-09 school year so that, again, we're coordinating when the resources will be available to the capacity of the system. We asked, you know, what are elements in the request that were one-time either investments or bonding opportunities so that we could utilize operations dollars in a different way. And we wanted to make sure that the system was ready for the component pieces that we included. And so we laid out a chart, not just looking at this biennia, but actually looking at several biennia, saying how do we phase this in over, say, 6-8 years so that we know the targets we're aiming and we're putting the pieces together to move that direction. And so the last very small printed sheet we gave you shows those top items that we were able to put in the governor's budget. And we tried to illustrate here for you when you see that the agency request was one number and the governor's recommended budget was another. Oftentimes it was because of that implementation phase-in that we talked about or kind of reprioritizing some of the money. So I also want to give you then quickly four examples of how integrated these proposals are. And the first is the data system. And we've talked about this a great deal over the past several years, but the data system sheet, and I'm sorry I'm flipping through these so quickly. The data system sheet, though, shows you all the component pieces. At K-12, we have the Kids Phase 3 piece, which is that horizontal alignment of the K-12 system, school district to school district. We have the articulation transfer program, the Atlas, which is what will allow students to be able to go online and actually, you know, enter the kinds of classes that they have taken that are college credit classes and ask themselves, so if I want to complete my degree at Portland State, how will these classes apply to the degree that I'm interested at Portland State? Or if I want to go to University of Oregon, how would it apply there? So that we're trying to open up the process to make it, again, more accessible to students, and we need the budget in order to drive that. And then the information data system, which is, again, we're trying to, the next phase of building the vertical alignment, K-12, community college, university. We have financial aid data system pieces here, and then, of course, the community college piece. And I'll just make one highlight here. There isn't a major ask for the alignment piece inside the community college request this time, because they recognize that we needed to get the community, we need to get the K-12 system in place and the university piece in place, so that when we create their part, it is the correct match. And so again, we're trying to be very strategic as far as how we're aligning these requests. The next example is the healthcare workforce. Again, throughout the entire enterprise, we have key components that are going to help us address the healthcare workforce shortage in this state, whether it's nursing, allied health, doctors, et cetera. And so again, you see that as the Department of Education, State Board of Education has dealt with new math and science requirements, they looked at it from the standpoint of what does that mean for post-secondary, and what does that mean for those students that are entering the workforce? How does that translate into the community colleges needing to expand their nursing and allied health training programs? What are the construction pieces that need to accompany those pieces? And so, again, we tried to just lay out here very quickly for you so that you can see that there was this very tight alignment throughout the system. This, and using this, again, as an example, is a case where, for instance, for us to enhance nursing in the state of Oregon, one of the component pieces we need is to have faculty members who are properly trained to be teachers in the nursing programs. And so again, we're just making sure that all of those pieces are aligned so that when we want to increase that opportunity for students, we have the faculty members that are properly trained to be there. The new diploma requirement, which is the next slide, again, just shows how we're trying to show you how this ties in with all the other pieces, including Oregon Inc. and the ETIC proposals that we also wrote in, rolled into the connection here. The shared responsibility model, which Commissioner Adams talked about a moment ago, and if I could highlight that for just a moment, the shared responsibility model is going to be a wonderful opportunity for Oregonians and potential students. But we also realized that that couldn't be the only piece that was expanded. So two other elements that are in the budget are, one, the Aspire program, which is an attempt to reach back into our high schools, provide volunteers to help our students understand all the hurdles they have to go over just to apply for financial aid, and what that means, because oftentimes these students have parents or family members that have never gone through this experience, and it's not easy. We also have a pilot program, a rural outreach program, where we have recognized that, again, first-generation students in our rural communities who have never thought about going to a community college or a university, not just because of financial aid issues, but recognizing that, in fact, their academic performance is properly preparing them for it. So this is a program where we're going to pilot, again, this reach back into our middle schools and our high schools to help connect so that they become eligible for the shared responsibility model. And then I quickly made a few items here of just some sector-specific examples, like the pre-kindergarten Head Start program that comes out of the Department of Education, the growth assessment model, which is a model that we requested the federal government to recognize that under No Child Left Behind. They have not recognized our program yet, but we feel so strongly that we're going to move ahead with it, and we're actually charts student growth so that we know that individual students are making progress as opposed to cohorts having a one-size-fits-all hurdle to clear. The alignment work of the Community College Workforce Development Department, The limiting the increase in tuition to median family income for the university system. Again, this is part of a five-biennial plan that we've laid out so that we can restore the stability and the infrastructure and the investment into our university system so that, in fact, we have the programs that are needed. And then we spent a great deal of time talking about cross-sector accountability. You know, we have we reviewed all the performance measures of the enterprise. We recognize that there are a lot of them, a lot of performance measures. And so that one of those opening charts I had where we had the one-page description of the enterprise, and we had those, we had identified the five goals of the enterprise. What we did is we sat down with, again, all the key people in the sectors, and we said, if as a state, as an education system, these are the five goals, what is it that you contribute towards helping to move the state towards these high-level goals? And so that you can begin to separate what are performance measures that maybe inside an institution or a sector they'd want to be tracking, but how does that then relate to how the system is doing to move the state of Oregon forward towards these higher goals. So, again, once again, trying to get a kind of a system view of it.
We're just also, I'm not, you're doing great with time.
I
just one, could you briefly sort of define the shared responsibility model so everyone understands that? I know we're asking you to
That's okay.
2 hours, and but I'm not sure that it's, yeah.
Absolutely. Thank you, Chair Galizia. The shared responsibility model. Currently, we have the Oregon Opportunity Grant, which is designed as a need-based program, and it provides some assistance to the most needy Oregonians in the state. But as was mentioned, there's a cliff that if you make over $33,100, your family, your child doesn't qualify. And we've also discovered that even the size of the grant that we're currently providing to many of the most needy Oregon students isn't enough for them to be able to attend a community college or university. So we did about 18 months worth of work to look at how can we restructure our thinking. And the approach was to say, what level of responsibility should we assume that the student could take on? And it was designed around the criteria of being able to work 40 hours a week during the summer and 10 to 15 hours a week during the school year, that was a reasonable amount of work that students could carry out. At Oregon minimum wage, and what level of resource could that bring to bear? And if they're going to a community college, our calculations were that they would not have to borrow any money. If they went to the university, they would have to borrow some money. So what level of borrowing was appropriate? And national studies, the Oregon Student Association helped us with this. National studies showed that we need to keep that total at the end of 4 years under $13,000. So part of the plan is built around that structure. So students have about 50% of the responsibility in their share. And then what level of family, whether they're a dependent student or an independent student, what level does the federal government put in because of Pell Grants and now tax credits as we move into middle class? And then the state of Oregon comes in and says, we're going to fill in the gap between what that amounts to and what you need to be able to go so that the financial barrier will be removed for Oregonians. And now they can focus on, do I have the academic preparedness and do I have the commitment to be able to move forward?
Thank you. So, I appreciate that.
Okay. So on the performance measures and trying to lay this out, if, as many of you know, all of you know, education isn't like building a building. We don't just pour the foundation and, you know, 6 months later we've got this structure and now it's being used. It takes a period of time to recognize that the program that we implement this fall is going to have an impact on students down the road, regardless of where it's added in the system. So, again, looking at performance measures and looking at the budget and aligning those to say, let's look at an investment window of time, 6 to 8 years, where if we invest this kind of money, here's the expectation that we have, and it gives education the opportunity to actually track the growth towards those targets. As a state, we should be setting those targets and then letting the enterprise do what it needs to do to move towards that. So it was aligning performance measures longer period of time and an investment to support the effort that will be needed. A couple other quick things that we're also building as we speak. And in fact, I'll highlight him, Professor Wayne Wakeland, who is in the System Science Department here at Portland State University. One of his students is an employee of the Oregon Department of Education. We've been working with her to design a very dynamic, what we're calling a yield model, but I'm sure the professor has a different word for it. But what we're trying to do is we've set a goal of 2025 to have 40% of Oregonians with a two-year degree or professional certificate, another 40% with a four-year or higher degree. As you look at that, you have to ask yourself, so what investment do we make? What can we expect would be the change in the current outcome that we have to do that? This one chart here is just showing you how the model we're creating is going to be very dynamic, but on the next page I gave you just a few very quick examples. The baseline, currently we have about over 33,000 high school graduates moving through the system, about 7,900 community college graduates, and public universities about 10,000. So you have to ask yourself, if we could increase the graduation rate at the high schools from 67 to 75%, what does that mean for the system? Not only what would the results be, but then again, tying back to budget, so what are the programs and support systems and investment need to be there for that effect? What would happen if we increase the retention rate at community college and university, again, tied back to shared responsibility model possibly? What if we increase that by 10%? How does that impact the system? And so what we think is that this model is going to give us a real tool, both in the governor's office and the legislature, to be able to have much better data to make these kinds of investment decisions. And the last new program that I also want to highlight very quickly is we have Nancy Heiligman, who currently is at Oregon State University, also on contract with us to help us. She helped us create the K-12 database initiative several years ago. She's now helping us put together expanding that to include the post-secondary system. We've been working with people like John Tapania, who I think might be here in the audience, and the Oregon Business Council and others to try and put a much more dynamic modeling of the budget together, so again we can see where the money is going and what the results are and the data that supports it. And that that last page is just an example of we're able to disaggregate a lot of data from the K-12 system and begin to do analysis work on that, and we're working now to see how we can disaggregate a little more of the data post-secondary system so we understand that better. So again, these two models we think are going to be extremely helpful for all of us. In short, the coordination, both programmatic, and that drives the budget decisions. We looked at multiple biennials so that we're trying to lay the foundation this biennial, so what the next investment would be that we can talk about where we're moving to. By coming at that approach, for instance, we're able to project out that by 15 biennial, we believe we can be at 96% of the quality education model for K-12. I mean, we can begin to set targets for ourselves and say, what program needs to be there, what investment needs to be there for the program, whether it's post-secondary or K-12 or Head Start. The last the separate document that all of you have is just the breakdown of each of the major sectors' budgets, just so that you had the names and numbers of the packages that were included that you could look at. And I had a very good example shared with me the other day to try to describe the coordination of this budget. And that is, if you think about the Roman Arch, was built at, was able to hold roads and aqueducts and kind of weather the test of time, but if you remove one little piece from that arch, it falls apart. It's the structure that holds it together. And so while I'm not trying to imply that, boy, you move any money around, the budget's going to fall apart, but it really was that effort to make sure that the coordination was across sectors and that, in fact, the policy decisions, the programs we believe students need, drove the budget decisions.
Thank you. Thank you very much for condensing at least a two-hour discussion into a brief period of time.
I hope I made 20 minutes.
Yeah, I think you're right around there. So that's, I really appreciate that. I think the Roman aqueduct metaphor works well after we just walked through Lincoln Hall, so I think that was pretty appropriate. All right,
I'm going to. Winter, those walls are being held up.
Yes, yes. So, and I'm going to see if anyone has any questions or comments. Senator Walker.
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Sager. I just want to let the committee know our policy committee had a wonderful presentation yesterday. The governor came in and testified and shared the model with on Senate Bill 334. Our anticipation is to move that bill out pretty soon. We're going to be hearing it in Ashland on Friday and then probably move it pretty soon after that for a work session to send it down here so we can talk about it. I do want to just state that in the testimony we got yesterday, I indicated that last session we expanded the Opportunity Grant Program, and I was disappointed because we had left some money on the table that not everyone took advantage of the program. I've had conversations with Senator Devlin about some of those reasons why, and some of it was our own doing because we didn't get out of the legislature until August. So no one knew that money was available. So probably the soonest students could obtain any money for it was winter term. Also, we just didn't do enough marketing and letting students know it was available. And also, I think third, most importantly, is there wasn't, the grants were not big enough. They were only 11% of really what a student needed. And as I indicated, I got my start with the Oregon Need Grant, which is now the Opportunity Grant. And I just want to continue that opportunity. So I see this shared responsibility model, particularly with the step increase in the Aspire program, because that's where you're going to market this, is really a neat way to make sure that we can expand the program and do what we need to make sure that we have those opportunities here in Oregon. So I just want to compliment the governor and his staff for putting this together, and I'm real anxious for you all to see it when it comes down to committee, and that will be shortly.
Thank you, Senator Walker. Senator Devlin.
Thank you. I'm not trying to play to the home crowd here. one of the items included in the governor's budget this time that was included last time also, but it was changed in the last days of the session, was enrollment growth, funding for enrollment growth. If you make it possible for more students to attend our university system, but we can't keep the money in the budget for the enrollment growth, you put an institution like PSU and a few others in real trouble. How committed is the governor in this budget to holding the enrollment growth line?
I'm putting light on this.
Senator Devlin, thank you for the question. Before I answer it directly, yes, the governor sees that connection very clearly. What a shame for us to do the outreach and the marketing on the shared responsibility model only to have students show up and find out that there aren't classes available or the only classes that are available don't apply towards their degree, et cetera. So the governor is very committed to the enrollment growth and at community college, we don't call it enrollment growth, it's just the basic support fund. So in both of those arenas that he's very committed to reinvesting in those systems because we've had 15 years of major disinvestment and now we have to, again, rebuild that stability and rebuild that structure.
Senator Morgan?
Well, the chair just kind of gave me the elbow and said, no one's asking any tough questions. So,
sorry. I didn't phrase it. Well, yeah, I did. That's exactly what I said.
I'm curious. One of the things that we spend a lot of times contemplating in the budget arena is the future cost of the programs that we put in place. And the governor in his budget has been very generous in all the areas of education. And I think that there are a number of us that appreciate what he has stepped up and done for this sector of the budget, because it's very obvious, I think, no matter where you come from the state to serve in Salem, no matter what your political persuasion is, that education is a cornerstone and it's critically important to the future of the state. But that being said, the budget process is somewhat analogous to a construction project where we have to build the whole house, not just one room. And we also have to look forward in time to the impacts that these investments are going to have in future budget years. There are some, because a number of these initiatives start late in the biennium, the impact on this biennium's budget is minimal compared to the impact on subsequent bienniums, which there is a rather staggering aspect to the roll-up costs of this initiative. And I'm wondering what the conversations around that were as you were formulating the concept.
Chair DeLisio, thank you. Representative Morgan, thank you really for that question, and I do appreciate it. We've had a lot of conversations, and the governor has spoke often on this subject. You know, the research, or the researchers have stated over and over again that if we educate and train people to be able to take care of themselves and their family, then in fact we reduce the pressure on the criminal justice system, we reduce the pressure on the social safety net. At some point in time, you have to make the decision that, in fact, that's the investment you're going to make, is into the lives of Oregonians, their education, their training. And that's what the governor has done. That's just a philosophical decision that he made, that we could no longer continue to kind of thin the soup. At some point, you have to say, if we're going to drive this economy and if we're going to reduce the pressure on those other sectors, you got to invest in education training throughout the continuum, because you can't wait for the Head Start children to make it through the system and begin impacting. You have to impact the entire system. So philosophically, that's where the governor came from. We've also looked at what the roll-up costs of these programs are, and we've looked at what the current revenue projections are for the next few biennias. And in fact, we believe that there are ways that we can get there and support this initiative. We're going to have differences of opinion with some of you as to what those steps are, but that's the legislative process, and that's why we all like being here. So I don't want to sound flip, but we do look forward to working with you on trying to align this. Another reason why we looked out over several years, because even the $2 billion worth of requests that came from the education enterprise were after some real soul searching from the sector saying, okay, what's the level of our ask? So if people ask for everything that we believe students need today, whether it's based on the quality ed model for K-12 or the modeling that our community colleges and university systems have been doing to try and identify the need and what is needed, we can't do that in one step. But we can begin to build hope in people that, in fact, over a period of time, we can lay out a game plan to reach that target. That's what this is, the base budget to start, and that's what the governor's funding plan tries to lay out.
And if I might just I would most resoundingly express my appreciation to the leadership that the governor has shown, especially in the four-year part of the system. The energy that he injected into the Higher Ed Commission and the reorganization that's gone on there, and the work that's been done over the last, since he's been governor, that have melded the pieces together, the last 2 years of the high school system with the community college system and the higher ed system. I think it's been very gratifying to see that all unfold, and that the legislature has been a very willing partner in those discussions. And I think that there also is a great willingness to continue this program, but I think that there also is a more of a reality check here on the fiscal side that we have to go through before we'll be at something that is doable for the state.
Representative Morgan, thank you. And yes, we understand. Again, we do look forward to working with all of you on this.
Senator Devlin.
I'm helping Mr. Bender here. On the OUS side, maybe just simply because of historical context, maybe simply because we've designed a system in terms of capital that has transformed over a period of time, we sort of have a rationale now. I mean, in the sense that one time for G bonds, we paid the full cost. We just, you know, we decided which projects. And for a number of years now, we've been saying, go out, raise the money, raise half, we'll put in the other half. And the university goes through a very extensive decision process to determine what their priorities are, and also to look at deferred maintenance. Now I can look over here at Mr. Pullman. We don't have that kind of a history on the community college side. And one of the things that we're struggling with in Ways and Means is that for the first time in like 25 years, I believe about 25 years, we agreed to fund some community college capital needs in the last session. Not everything that the governor requested, not everything that some of us desired. But the governor has a very large community college proposal. I'll put it in context. He's got a proposal that's about one-third the cost of the next prison that we will build somewhere in Oregon. But he has a very large proposal. We don't really have a history. And we don't really have sort of a common understanding in the building on community colleges and what the state's role is. How in one session's time are we going to kind of develop that? And that's the debate that Representative Galizio and I are going to have with the co-chairs, because I think we're both going to be advocates, but we have to deal with co-chairs that really worry legitimately how they pay for the cost of operating the system in the future, because anything that you have in debt service is dollars that you do not have available to operate.
Chair Galizio, Senator Devlin, you're absolutely right. And the governor, again, because the governor clearly sees the community colleges as a part of the state's education enterprise and the vital role that community colleges play in the system, not just as a conduit to the university system, but they are the primary providers of workforce training in the state of Oregon. So if we're going to provide the workforce that this state needs, that our economy needs, we need to be able to support the community colleges. Why there was a 25-year gap between the last time we invested and this past biennia is a good question. It may have to do with the fact that we had invested prior, and you know there was a way to raise money locally, and so that the community colleges were able to do the building process. Now, though, it is clear that what we are asking of community colleges to do, we need to help them build the structures, whether it is new facilities or upgrading their labs so that they can add more nursing and allied health programs. So the governor sees a real connection with those and believes very strongly that they need to be in there. As far as debt service, we work very closely with the treasurer's office in making sure that the debt load was under what the bonding houses in New York and other places required as the criteria for the state. And here's where also the budget is connected. If, in fact, we're successful at putting together a rainy day fund, that is going to improve our credit rating, which will mean that our debt load calculation is better. So, I mean, these things, again, work together. We need to invest in the infrastructure. It puts Oregon people to work in family wage jobs, puts money back into the economy. It supports the infrastructure we need for future training. And, by the way, if we get a rainy day fund, the debt service calculation is improved, and you know we're further ahead as a state.
When we get a rainy day fund, not if.
I'm sorry. Yes, when okay. We finally vote on that, that would be great.
This is true. We do.
Can I just
ask Representative Morgan. Absolutely.
I know that you, the people that are out here that aren't ordinarily wonked out with us in these discussions, don't know that Senator Devlin chaired this committee in the last session, and I chaired this committee in the session before. So we often get involved in conversations that people just kind of roll their eyes and walk off and don't want to talk to us anymore. But the capital construction projects are something that is an area where we need to put a focus of energy. because the state, in my opinion, simply doesn't have the economic capacity to be able to step up the way that we should for capital construction projects, even in the Oregon University system, let alone the community college system. And one of the things that's been very gratifying to me is to work with especially the OUS system on some very creative ways to fund the buildings. And there is, I think, tremendous, very bright people that are working on these kinds of things in the system. And we've put some innovative funding kind of deals together over the last few years that I think have enabled us to do things that we couldn't ordinarily do if we stayed with the same kind of a funding formula. I really salute the Portland State's commitment to put a commercial aspect into the building so they have a funding stream to pay back from those kinds of things and to try to build in things so that the whole capital construction project doesn't depend on G-bonds and donations. But I think that that is one of the frustrations that we do feel in the legislative arena, is that we simply don't have the capital that's needed to take care of these issues. The deferred maintenance issue itself is staggering in the system.
Representative Morgan, you're right. The deferred maintenance backlog for the university system alone is somewhere around $600 million. You add whatever the deferred maintenance is for the community colleges, and now there have been several conversations around trying to expand our assistance to the K-12 system, and I mean, that number just is blown out of the water. So we have a major backlog of work that needs to be done, and in working with the university system and the community college system, again, we've tried to not only prioritize those projects, but also make sure that we attach the right funding sources to the projects to make sure that we utilize those dollars the best way we can.
Yeah, and again, very briefly, I think it is most definitely to the credit of the university system that they've been so robustly involved in developing a pool of benefactors that are willing to support these programs, because without them, this would not be happening.
Absolutely.
One more question for Mr. Sager from Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sager, like my colleagues before me, I would like to commend you on the work that you've done to put together this program. I ran on the notion of a unified, transparent budget across the full spectrum of education, so I'm glad to see a program of this type. My colleagues have expressed some concerns about the capital construction budget. I'm also concerned about the human capital side of things. Oregon suffers from one of the worst full-time to part-time faculty ratios in the country, and I'm also concerned, especially in the area of the health professions field, how we expect to fill positions with qualified educators.
Chair Galizia, Representative Edwards, thank you for those questions. Yes, part of the proposal that the governor has put forward with the help of the university system is to begin to address both through the enrollment growth dollars and through the student faculty ratio dollars, begin to address that challenge that we have in the state. We have asked our faculty members to take on a larger and larger load, and that has an impact on quality, and we need to make sure that we maintain quality. And despite those challenges, our community college and university faculty have done a wonderful job of stepping up and making sure that students don't suffer. But that can only go so long, and we need to begin to invest in it. Specifically on the healthcare, that's why it is so important that the OHSU is a real partner in this effort, because, in fact, it's part of their proposal that is going to help us increase our faculty so that we can turn around to the community colleges and keep this pipeline going. We believe that we have the capacity to meet the needs as we have outlined in the budget, with the programs that are outlined in the budget, recognizing that part of what we're putting into OHSU, in fact, is putting out that faculty that in 09-11 and beyond are going to be available for the next steps.
Thank you. And quickly, hearkening back to your earlier comments about the Rainy Day Fund.
Yes.
I'll be carrying a rainy day fund bill to the House floor on Tuesday, so any lobbying efforts you'd like to offer would be much appreciated.
I know we've been involved with that. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you. Mr. Sager, I just want to thank you again for making the trip out here and addressing the panel, and we got some good questions and hopefully stimulate some more dialogue. So thank you again very much. Really appreciate you coming out. Thank you. Okay, now it's time for student perspectives. Remember them? Students? Yes, we're at a college. So I have the Associated Student President of Portland State University, Courtney Morse. I see her coming up. And then also I have on the agenda listed the Mount Hood Community College Vice President, Sean Robinson. And it looks like maybe even more folks. Oh, Mr. Robinson.
Good evening, Chair Galizio and members of the committee. I'd like to thank you for allowing us the opportunity to speak today. I appreciate the time. My name is Courtney Morse. As said, I am the student body president at Portland State University and the vice chair for the Oregon Student Association, and I'm really glad you're able to make it to campus today. I'd like to start by saying that post-secondary education has opened many doors for me, including the opportunity right now to speak with this committee on issues impacting students. I've researched the most pressing issues of our time and have found my passion in community organizing. But while some doors have been opened, much of my future is in doubt. In just a few years, I will be graduating and applying for a job that allows me the opportunity to work for the public, and this sector does not pay very highly. And I will be graduating thousands in debt with a high interest rate on most of my loans. While I am committed to working for the public sector, I worry almost every day about how I will pay back my loans with such an aggressive interest rate at 14.25%. In Oregon, the fact is post-secondary education is not as accessible as it used to be. Tuition and fees have increased greatly with such amounts of $1,500 at PSU alone in the last 5 years. In addition, fees are not included in the cost of education are popping up to cover the lack of state funds. Even though we are paying more, we are sitting on the floors in our classroom, our pipes are rusting, and we are borrowing just for basic maintenance of our buildings. The education enterprise is not just a conversation about better linking the different sectors of education, but is a long-term plan to ensure adequate funding for all parts of educating a citizen. It is more important than ever before that K-12 community colleges and universities work together to provide a seamless track of education for Oregonians. The governor's budget is a comprehensive of many budget needs of our university, no matter the location. It provides funding to ensure that we begin to slowly increase faculty salaries to the level of the peers. It brings down the student-faculty ratio over the next 5 years, and it funds enrollment growth, which as mentioned, is a huge issue here at PSU. Our campus is largest in the state, but many of the students get no state resources because of enrollment growth that has not been funded in so many years. Lastly, the operating budget ensures that tuition does not increase above the median family income. With this investment, tuition will not outpace a family's ability to pay. In addition, the governor proposes that universities keep interest earnings on tuition, which we would like to reinvest in our education. The governor's current proposal gives the university the ability to keep interest earnings, but also cuts an equal amount, $19 million, from the general fund. We propose that we keep the interest earnings without shifting funds from the general fund. Students have prioritized these funds to go to student services, faculty salaries, and buying down resource fees. We have asked that $10 million go to student services, which have seen the largest cuts on campuses. These services have proven to help students through their sophomore year and to help them graduate in a timely manner. It creates for our university stability of enrolled Oregon students. The board has asked that $6 million of the $19 million be put to faculty salaries. Currently, Oregon's professors are getting paid on average 78% to their peers across the country. Campuses report an astonishing high number of failed searches or the inability to recruit their first choice. This plan would allow us to catch up in a decade to the national average. Finally, $3 million would go towards buying down resource fees. These are additional fees that are charged for specific majors. It is an issue of access to an education where you're not charged for your life goals, but for lack of funds. The governor's budget, in partnership with the additional resources from interest, would finally allow us to fund the gaps in critical areas of our university's priorities. I strongly support the governor's capital construction budget. This would allow PSU to finally address the deferred maintenance money for buildings like Lincoln Hall, which you just had the opportunity to tour. For many years, the university system has been working to fund deferred maintenance, but because of budget cuts and other priorities, we have continued to learn in buildings that are unsafe and need repairs. The current proposed budget begins to invest in maintenance as well as fund new buildings that alumni have supported, and are needed to house our growing enrollment. Before I end, I would also like to mention OSA's other legislative priorities, which other people will be talking about tonight. The shared responsibility model, Aspire, and tuition equity are all important programs and good steps in providing a college education to all students, no matter their background. The governor's educational enterprise works to ensure an adequately funded, seamless education for all Oregonians. And we think that our package ensures that all Oregon high school graduates will have access to a quality education at a university or community college. Both visions of funding truly complement each other and put us on the right track in Oregon. Tomorrow, students will rally at the steps of the Capitol. And as you look out or hear our gathering of chanting students, I ask you to remind yourself that you were once there too. I guess it ultimately allowed you to be sitting where you are today. But the reality is now that there are real prices and burden for this choice to pursue an educated society when we are graduating such debt. It is a burden I have chosen in order to give back to my community to serve the public. Because of college, I've had the opportunities that I never thought would exist. Since moving from Wisconsin, getting involved, I have been able to speak at press conferences with David Wu, testify before this committee, and discuss issues with national politicians. I've had the ability to run campaigns on issues affecting the environment, social justice, and student advocacy for the past 3 years. I have lobbied, learned government processes, and won an elected position within student government. Most importantly, I feel that I am gaining critical skills to give back to my community. And because of college, I have had these abilities. And I ask that I have the opportunity when I graduate to give back in even a greater way. By helping students achieve success now, ultimately, you are planning success. You are sponsoring a recipe for a stronger Oregon. Thank you.
Madam President, if I may,
Mr. Chair,
cavorting around with members of Congress, and I guess this today is a kind of a step down for you.
Yes.
So we really appreciate the fact that you would even show up. So I have to say. I want the committee to take note that you used the word when you talked about tomorrow at the Capitol steps. You used the word gathering and not demonstration or protest. Was that a purposeful use of the word gathering?
Sure. It is a gathering meant to signify the importance of this issue. I've been on a strict coffee of diet to talk to all the of caffeine to talk to all the students on our universities. This is a huge issue. I mean, we are 46th in the nation when it comes to funding for schools, and students have noticed it directly in their pocketbooks. And so we've actually, it's interesting, ironic that we're skipping class to go rally for this important issue. But we're going to be there, and it will be a gathering and some chantings, and hopefully it won't get too rowdy.
Okay. We welcome you, and I think it's great that you'll be down there. And, I don't expect you to share any sort of personal financial information, but I have to say I was kind of shocked when I heard of the interest rate that you were talking about on the loan. So without getting into sort of personal, I mean, can you? I was just shocked by that.
Most are, Chair. Thank you for the question. My parents aren't able to contribute to my education. I don't mind sharing that they both filed for bankruptcy, and so because of that, I've had to take out alternative loans due to my own credit. And since I am such a high-risk student with not very much credit, I'm pretty much borrowing most of my money to attend school here, which is why they're charging me at the 14.25% rate through Sallie Mae. It's every summer a gamble to see if I can even return to Portland State.
Mr. Chair.
That's amazing. That's incredible. Representative Jensen.
I thought we, in the interim, passed a loan shark bill. I'm appalled, quite honestly.
Oh, no.
Just appalled. I wish there were something that was in the power of this committee to, to address this right now, but that's a little beyond our scope at this particular moment, but certainly, waking your legislators up and your congressmen and others that you come in contact with about this cost and what students are having to bear in order to go to school. Now, I happen to be one that thinks it's probably very good, as you are doing,
having to sacrifice a little bit to go to school. I don't think there's anything particularly wrong with that. But I know, as I've talked to students over the last few years, the debt loads that they have when they're coming out of school, it's just absolutely astronomical. And it certainly limits you as a productive member of society to have to carry that debt load. It limits you in getting into, you know, the kind of quote-unquote normal adult type of life that probably all of us have looked forward to when we were college students. So, I commend all of the students at Portland State and every place else who make this significant financial sacrifice to go to school. I wish you the best, the very, very best of luck on that.
Chair Glazio, Senator, thank you for your sympathy.
Thank you, Representative Jensen. Senator Devlin.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think one of the things relative to student loans that I think is probably pretty apparent, and when we get into the discussion later in committee and a future date, the Student Assistance Commission, we can get into this in more detail, is that when you have an opportunity grant that only pays 11%, when you have student aid that is in the form of loans but that is capped at certain amounts depending upon where you are in terms of your undergraduate years, and when you're in a situation where your parents can't pick up the rest, and you're and even working practically full time, which I think many PSU students do, you're put in a position of having to borrow through alternative means at very high interest rates. And it obviously did not help at all that even for those loans that are not alternative, that the federal government almost close to doubled the interest rates that those loans were at. I know that there's a movement afoot to try to turn that back, and I hope that's successful. But in terms of practically doubling with that interest rates, they turned students' obligations overnight into much heavier obligations than they were before when they were at the lower interest rates.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Walker?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Morris testified in front of our Policy Education Committee, and we all had the same reaction. I got notes sent way down the dais that said, this is obscene. Sallie Mae is a federally backed loan program. It is obscene that they're charging 14.25% interest. I've had conversations with our congressional leaders about this, and there is a movement to change, roll back those interest rates, and also to increase the Pell Grants, because those were cut off pretty substantially, too. I know my daughter's in graduate school right now, and oh my word, that is so expensive. But she had to get some alternative loans also because she had maxed out on the loans that were available through the school, but they don't even come anywhere close to 14.25. So it's an illustration in how we also have to work with our federal partners on making sure that we can make this all work. Representative Morgan is right. You know, we can't fund it all, and we have to be smart about it, but it requires cooperating with congressmen, we have one congressional member in Congress that's a woman, but it's talking to Congress about the importance of understanding what that means to you. I mean, that's a huge debt load, 14.25% interest, and it stops, your interest stops while you're in school, but it starts up again, and I don't know. I quite frankly don't know how you're going to manage. And I can tell you right now, as a court reporter for bankruptcy court for the last 24 years now, you cannot discharge student loans unless you are practically dead crawling and unable to work, because the government is a loan shark. I mean, they will not let you go away. So it is. I just want you to be careful with your debt load, and we're going to continue to work on that with you and continue to write your letters to Congress and make sure that they pay attention to that, because we can't impact those federal loan rates. But that's why this program, as you pointed out, Ms. Morris, is so important for this shared responsibility model, because it's the only way you're going to finish school.
Thank you, Senator. Oh, I'm sorry. Ms. Morris.
Oh, I just want to say thank you. I appreciate the sentiment. And it is an issue of access and affordability. And I actually made the decision over winter term not to leave college because of the burden to pursue my education, because I want to contribute to Oregon. And I'm delaying buying cars and houses because of this debt, which won't contribute to the economy. But I appreciate very much your sentiment and encourage you to do all you can. And also, Sean here is ready to speak whenever you're ready about community colleges. So
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. I'll turn it over to you, Mr. Robinson.
Thank you, Chair and members of this committee. My name is Sean Robinson. I'm the Associate Student from Mount Hood Community College Vice President. And I'd just like to take this personal time to thank you for allowing me this opportunity to testify. Courtney has just finished discussing the need for funding universities, and I want to follow this up with the other variable in the equation, and that's the importance of funding our community colleges. The piece of the education enterprise that we like the most is that it recognizes the important role each education sector plays in producing educated Oregonians to join our workforce. Community colleges play a critical role in providing this educational access to a variety of citizens. These citizens may be those who don't immediately follow the college path right after their high school graduation due to family or other obligations. Some of these can't afford the costs of a four-year university and thus elect to go to a community college, or simply those who are trying to retrain themselves and specialize in a two-year degree or certificate program and thus be competitive in our constantly changing job market. The education enterprise recognizes the role that community colleges play and ensures that we are part of the funding conversation when it comes to dollars for a seamless transition. A seamless transition between community colleges and universities is critical for our students. The community college and university systems have worked hard over the last 4 years to better align our courses and thus enable a smoother transfer degree and admission process. A seamless transfer process is absolutely necessary to ensure that our students who have already paid thousands of dollars and months of their time to take these classes are not forced to retake the same classes again and repay for the same classes. Mount Hood Community College is working with Portland State University and Eastern Oregon University to make sure that we provide a clear path for our four-year degrees. The governor's commitment to educational enterprise has helped the colleges and boards of education work together on this essential part of our higher education equation. Similar to what Courtney said, the investment at community colleges could not come at a more critical time. Oregon's 17 community colleges are in dire need of additional resources. Since 2001, statewide, we've lost over 50,000 Oregonians in our community college system. While enrollment is slowly starting to climb up again, we are still educating significantly less students than we did in 2001. This trend is very disturbing. The state is in need of educated citizens that can fill our workforce and keep it nationally and internationally competitive. Yet in the midst of this globalized market, we are still educating less Oregonians in the community college system than we did 5 years ago. More disturbing is the facts that are linked to this. While some of it may chalk up to a gloomy economy, it does not answer why enrollment has dropped so significantly throughout the state with community colleges. Even in the midst of the troubled economy in the 70s, Mount Hood Community College continued to see enrollment increases as access to education and tuition was preserved. For the first time in Mount Hood's history in 2001, we had a decrease in enrollment and had a decrease ever since. The real reason for enrollment dips correspond with real tuition increases and real program cuts. Over the past 6 years, community colleges have been forced to cut course sections offered to students. With a lack of funds, they've been forced to eliminate majors and departments. In 2003 and 2004, Oregon Community Colleges offered 12% less courses than in 2001, and today we're continuing to offer 7% less than in 2001. While majors were eliminated, tuition continued to climb. Students now are forced to pay more for an education that is providing them with less majors and less classes. At Mount Hood Community College, tuition has increased over 60% since 2001, and we have seen some real course and program eliminations, and we are but one example. Bottom line, increases in tuition have tried to replace state funds, but this has not been possible to replace all the cuts, and in the end has only limited our state's access to opportunity. Even though I am a veteran of Operation Iraqi Freedom, and thus received the GI Bill and scholarships in student government, I still have to work 15 to 20 hours a week to pay for the costs to go to a community college and avoid Courtney's debt. The governor's proposed budget is an excellent first step towards reinvesting in our community colleges. Although to close the gap on the 6 years of disinvestment, we need more resources to hold tuition down, expand our course offerings, especially in our nights and weekends classes for our working students. We need to invest in student services and improve access for disabled services for students, and thus increase enrollment to serve more students, which is necessary for our educated and working citizenry. We are working for $529 million to invest in our community college and fully invest in our community college. In addition to the base budget for community colleges, the capital construction budget is very necessary to support enrollment growth and for some campuses, basic structure needs. In Mount Hood, we are in dire need of a childhood development center to enable many of our single-parent students to afford the opportunity cost it takes just to sit down in a classroom, let alone do their homework. Thus, I urge you to pay special attention to Senate Bill 472, sponsored by Representative Lim and Senator Mons Anderson. Before I end, I want to talk today about the shared responsibility model, which you've also been talking about today. The governor, in his effort to make college more accessible, worked with universities, community colleges, independent colleges, students, and community groups to create a new financial aid model. The shared responsibility model is a solution as it defines what a student can actually afford to pay. Under the new model, students make the initial investment in their education through reasonable work hours, reasonable borrowing, and with their families contributing what is reasonably available to them. If students and families fulfill the requirements that the state expects of them, then Oregon can step in and fill that tuition affordability gap. Instead of awarding, and don't want to criticize in any shape or form the Oregon Opportunity Grant, but a family or a student earns $1 more, to deny them aid is simply ridiculous. And the shared responsibility model would afford grants based on the varying scales of individual needs and family income. With this model, students can once again work their way through college and not put their future at risk with staggering levels of debt. Students support the implementation of this model to ensure that we are educating all Oregonians no matter their background. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, and let's remember that we all want to keep Oregon strong.
Thank you very much, Mr. Robbins. Are you going to be there tomorrow, Capitol?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Please don't call me sir. Make me really. No, I appreciate it. Anyone on the committee have any questions or comments? The good news is we have quite a few people that want to testify, which is great. Also, that though presents time challenges. But Senator Devlin,
Mr. Chairman, only the request that I have that they leave a copy so that it can be made available to staff with their testimony.
Would that we appreciate that. And Representative Jensen.
Thank you. I'm becoming a little impatient with the universities and with community colleges over this issue of seamless education. I've been in this arena, not as a legislator, but the arena of the education for many years now. And in the last 5-6 sessions of the legislature have been encountering this. 26 years in education and a community college, and this was back in 1960s, this was the same sort of issue that was being raised. And when I first went to the legislature, some 10-plus years ago now, this was still an issue being raised. And I just, quite frankly, Mr. Chair, have about exhausted my patience for whatever that will be worth, on this. I think 40 years ought to be enough for community colleges and universities to get this act together.
Representative Jensen, thank you. And this actually is a pretty good segue, I would say, into, because the next panel, no, thank you very much. He sets it all up for me. So you guys are looking forward to that. any other comments?
Well, I will just say to Representative Jensen that last session that Mr. Sager mentioned it, Senate Bill 342 was a bill co-sponsored. I co-sponsored it with Senator Schrader, and it required the community colleges and the universities to get their act together and articulate their programs so you don't have students taking classes in community college that they find out when they get to the university don't count for the degree they're pursuing. And I think they've done extremely well with it. You're right, it took them too long to do it, and that's why we gave them a kick in the pants. But they're doing it, and I think they're doing it with the Atlas program. And so I anticipate that next session, Representative Jensen, you're going to be finally telling them that they figured it out after 40 years.
That would make my career.
All right.
All right. Ms. Morris and Mr. Robinson, thank you very much. You're obviously credits to your respective institutions, and you've been, I think this has been very useful and important testimony for this committee. So thank you for all you're doing, and we're going to try to support you as a committee in terms of the legislature, and we wish both of you the best of luck and look forward to seeing you tomorrow down in Salem.
Yeah, thanks.
Drive carefully. All right, now, with Representative Jensen's kind of tee-up, I'm very excited to call to the dais to talk about university and community college partnerships. Portland State University President Dan Bernstein and Portland Community College President Preston Pulliams.
And yes, Mr. Chair, I could read the agenda. I knew what was coming next.
Oh, well, I want to tell everybody.
SB 426. You'll always be on the record when it's enrolled.
We're ready.
All right. Well, first of all, I'm Preston Queen, District President of Portland Community College. I want to, Mr. Chair and to the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify to talk about our efforts along collaborative programs and how we're working together with among the community colleges with Portland State University. I've handed out a written report. I'll try to touch on some of these efforts. This is not inclusive of all the efforts, but some I think that would be relevant to share with you in terms of how we're moving forward on this front. Let me also acknowledge my co-presenters this evening, Dr. Bernstein, for his very cooperative spirit in terms of working with me when I arrived in the state 2.5 years ago, to extend the opportunities to work collaboratively, also with many of his faculty and staff members. To keep this relationship very strong, I must publicly admit that I have played customer golf with him and lost on a number of occasions to keep this relationship strong. So I've made a real sacrifice here in terms of my game and my ego, but it's for the good of the cause. Let me start by just saying, and I want to touch base on a couple of strategies that we are employing and working to employ to address this issue. First and foremost is efforts for dual enrollment. Dual enrollment, those students who enroll simultaneously at PCC and PSU, taking courses, participating in student activities at both of the institutions. Students who complete a program at PCC do not have to apply, by the way, again to enroll at PSU. They are automatically already accepted. There are now about 335 students between our institutions that are duly enrolled in just PSU and PCC. Obviously, benefits are there in terms of this process. One application, we can pool our advising sources, inclusive flexibility regarding scheduling courses for our students, because many of our students in our sector and community college sector are full-time workers and part-time students and also have families and other obligations. And this is a great option that they have. The opportunity to participate also in college life on both of our campuses. We get to also coordinate financial aid and scholarships as access to both institutions, library and labs on our campuses. It's simply an easier transition, particularly with students that have to apply at PSU after being accepted at PCC and being part of this program. And really a more affordable route to get a degree by starting at a community college in terms of tuition costs. That's one example in terms that we want to work very strongly to continue this opportunity. We're looking at expanding this, and we are now working in what we call a metro area PSU community college consortium, where PCC is working with PSU, Mount Hood, Clackamas, Chemeketa Community College. We're working to develop a consortium to develop even stronger links between our academic programs, our financial aid, our academic advising, our academic calendars, to make it easier for many hundreds more students to simultaneously attend our institutions. Theoretically, we like to arrive at a day when you enroll in one, you really enroll in all the other institutions in terms of what's happening in terms of students taking classes and support that effort. We're discovering that students are swirling in terms of their enrollment anyway. That if a class is offered at a convenient time at PSU, they will enroll. If they're offered a convenient time at PCC or Mount Hood. So they're already moving in terms among our institutions. We want to make this easier for them and support this effort. Let me talk for a moment about transfer and articulation. The majority, 67% of Portland Community College students who transfer to a four-year university attend PSU. So we work very hard to encourage our faculty to coordinate very closely with PSU faculty so students can transfer with viable coursework that will contribute to their majors. PCC recently converted our credit transfer courses from 3 credit hours to 4 credit hours to more closely align those credits being accepted at PSU. And that was a 2 or 3 year process within our organization, and we completed that last year. Let me give some specific examples of articulation agreements. We have one in graphic design where our PCC faculty are working with PSU faculty to design a curriculum so that the two college programs are aligned, easing, again, transfer and transition. We're now developing a partnership in performing and fine arts. Again, faculty and staff of the two colleges are working for coordination in theater, dance, and fine arts. Environmental sciences, PCC, PSU have a strong partnership with environmental sciences. Students who complete the environmental science program at PCC Rock Creek are admitted as juniors in the PSU program. In addition, a PCC faculty member teaches graduate-level environmental science courses at PSU. The schools also jointly apply for grants and use Rock Creek's Environmental Learning Center. We are also working very closely in terms of training paraprofessionals, formerly known as teacher aides. New federal guidelines require that teacher aides now called paraprofessionals, must have associate degrees. So PCC's program is helping these employees get those degrees. Students who complete the Associate of Science or Associate of General Studies can move from PCC's program, preparing people for assisting in the classroom into PSU's education program so they can continue their education and become certified teachers. PCC is working on the Associate of Science transfer degree, particularly for our students at our college, in various engineering programs so they can now transfer to PSU more easily. Two more partnerships, and then I'll just kind of make a closing remark. We're very proud of our Portland Teachers Program. This program is designed to grow our own teachers, particularly ethnic minorities. Students who take the first 2 years at PCC transfer to PSU's Teachers Preparation Program upon completion are guaranteed a teaching spot with the Portland Public Schools or Beaverton Public Schools. This has been a very successful, long-standing partnership that is paid for by our partners involved and also supported by grants from various institutions like Washington Mutual Bank. Last but certainly not least, we have an ESL lab school where our college has a lab school at PSU. It is staffed entirely by PCC instructors who, as part of a research project into ESL best practices, are recorded and evaluated by the PSU linguistic experts. The plan is that this study will produce information about best practices related to student achievement. The project is sponsored for PSU through a grant from Harvard University. We are in year 4 of a 5-year grant project. Learning has been significant, although there's much data to continue collecting this program. Bottom line for us, these are just some examples of relationships that we have. We are continually looking for opportunities to do more of this. It simply just makes a lot of sense. It makes us more efficient, and it provides certainly better flexibility and options for students. I would imagine my colleague, Dr. Bernstein, would like to say a few words.
Chair Colizio, members of the committee, as usual, I agree with almost everything Dr. Pulleys said. Actually, I was pleased this last weekend to be the scorekeeper with a pencil and an eraser that allowed Preston to shoot his lowest score ever. golf course. But in terms of our partnership, I said earlier that all roads lead to PSU, and in some respects, I was talking about the kind of multimodal transportation, but the reality is that in terms of delivering the educational product in the metropolitan region, we also see roads leading to PSU, and that's why we have seen it to be crucial to work with our community college partners to form this consortium that allows students to swirl, to move back and forth between PSU and the various community colleges. As Dr. Pulliams pointed out, 67% of the students who transfer from PCC transfer to Portland State. That number is true with respect to the other community colleges in the region. What we also found is that there are over 70 different traffic patterns of this swirling and the way that students use Portland State and the various community colleges in the region. And because of that, and with the cooperation of my community college colleagues, we've put together this consortium that really facilitates the swirling. Not only between, because what we found is that not only was it important for students not to lose credit as they transferred or as they moved from a community college to Portland State, but it was also important that they not lose credits as they moved from one community college to the other. And this consortium is really facilitating both of those. We also want to get to the point where the students can actually apply once to all of the institutions in the metropolitan region. One financial aid application and take that financial aid and use it throughout the consortium as well. I know it's taken a long time, Representative Jensen, but I think we're getting there. We see certainly a significant part of our growth. We're now 25,000 students and hope to be 35,000 students at some point. A lot of that growth will take place on the community college campuses and will allow us to leverage their facilities, their parking, their faculty to provide really a seamless education for the metropolitan region. And I think that my colleagues and I are really committed to making that happen. So I think Preston Williams and I are here today to commit to you that we want to continue to move forward to make this consortium work and to continue to provide a seamless education to the citizens in the region.
Thank you very much, Representative Morgan.
The dual enrollment agreements are critically important to the rural areas of the state, too, that those are the doorways that we have to get our students into the four-year institutions. And it has been, I think, very gratifying to watch the growth in the dual enrollment programs, not just in the metro area, but the twining together of the community college system and the four-year system all over the state. And I think that that's a huge piece to accessibility, especially in the rural parts of the state.
Thank you, Representative Morgan. Other questions or comments? Representative Jensen.
Having expressed my consternation a few moments ago, I would like to recognize to the Portland State, Dr. Bernstein, the apparent openness to working with this issue. And I do applaud that, and I do appreciate that it is a much better than it was. I'm only distressed that it did take as long as it took to get there, because there were an awful lot of young people, and some not so young people, who got lost in the cracks that had we had this in place would not have gotten lost in the cracks. And so, recognizing your contributions and how well things, how far things have come, I felt necessary simply to try to keep us on that track and moving down that path. Thank you very much for your hard work, both of you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Jensen.
One of the debates that we commonly have in the legislature, and we see this occurring both at PCC and at PSU and at similar institutions throughout the state, is students arriving from high school that are in need of remedial education. I was very much impressed recently when I visited with officials in New Mexico and found out how much the university system there, can't comment on the community colleges because I didn't meet with them, how much they worked with the local school district, and obviously where they were in Albuquerque, it was principally, I believe, one large school district. How much work do both of you do with local school districts, and how much of a challenge does it present to you, students that arrive at your door still needing remedial courses?
Ms. Sharon, Senator Devlin, certainly this is an area that we in the community college sector is very concerned about. We certainly do a substantial amount of remediation work. The number is probably one out of every three students we admit. Now, we are an open admitted institution, so we will see probably higher numbers than you would at the university level. But we are certainly engaged in this work. You know, it's part of our mission at the community college. You know, we believe you take the student, we openly enroll and admit, and we take the student from where, whatever level they start at. Unfortunately, there are some students that arrive that we have to do remedial work with. I think there are a number of conversations going on. First of all, I think the state's effort in terms of looking at standards and graduation requirements will move in a very positive way in this effort. But we're also working very closely with our high school partners in terms of what will it take to be successful at the college level. We are sponsoring a number of conversations, particularly with public schools, a number of high schools, particularly in impacted areas, where this may be a greater problem than some of the other areas. It's important to have the conversation. I think the work and data in terms of providing pathways for students so they can enroll and can arrive at the college, not only troubled by perhaps remedial performance, but also to be undecided in terms of what they'd like to do. So I think it's a very comprehensive problem and needs a very comprehensive approach. We're doing a number of efforts. We've discovered, for example, through our Gateway program, where we've even dealt with students who dropped out, that many of these students may not be doing well academically, not because they don't have the ability, but because they have other personal issues that are going on. So it's a very complicated problem, but I feel that, first of all, it's been recognized at the state level, and I've been approached by now a number of K-12 systems in terms of what can we do as a group to work through this.
Chair Galizio, Senator Devlin, the four-year institutions, and Portland State is no exception, are really becoming increasingly competitive. And so I think it would be a mistake for us to say that we're in the business of providing remedial education, although some of that certainly occurs. But I think the fact that we are working with our community college partners and that they have the dual admission for students who are already ready to go to PSU and the community college, but also providing seamless opportunities so that students, even though they may be in remedial programs at the community college level, are seeing their pathways to Portland State, I think is something that's critical. Also, our Graduate School of Education, of course, works very closely with the K-12 system to help address issues around remedial education. And at Portland State, we also have some of our first-year cohorts in the high schools. Our first-year University Studies curriculum that I mentioned earlier, we had a number of high schools in the metropolitan region. We've had to cut back on some of those efforts primarily because of resources. And so, in some respects, the reinvestment in higher ed will allow us to address issues around remediation and students' expectations of themselves. And in some sense, a lot of what we have to do is let students understand and convince students that they can do the work. And, for example, having our undergraduate curriculum in some of the high schools, for some of the students it provided them just 15 college credits, and that's fine. But for other students, it was really an opportunity for them to really see that they could compete and that they could do the work. And that's a very important step for students to take. And so, you know, all of those things really come together, and to the extent to which that we've been hampered, I think, in those efforts, I'm concerned around resources. And I'm hoping that the reinvestment that will occur in the session will allow us to work together to do more to address some of those issues.
Thank you. Yeah, final question, and then next I'm going to call because we're starting to run short on time, and I want to give the public testimony folks who've signed up. So next I would like to have Gary, is it Sailors?
Salyers.
Sorry about that. And Ray Gunther. If following this, if the two of you would come up at the same time, I'd appreciate that. So Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Devlin asked a very good question, and you gave some very good answers. I actually, though, want a little more detail because my policy committee is going to be addressing these education high school standards. I could probably tell you what I think you'll need most of the remediation work with, and that's grammar, spelling, reading. I'm beginning to feel that the phrase "these ones" is in the dictionary somewhere that I haven't been able to find, because I hear so many young people say that, and that it's just not proper grammar. But I'm curious, because they're increasing math and science, where is your most remediation work being done? Is it with English and grammar and reading, or is it math and science? Can you tell me that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, what we're discovering basically in two areas, the writing and math competition.
Okay.
We're just discovering that, and our employers in the area are also meeting with us and talking with us about needs as they see students who are graduating from high school coming into as employees, there are three issues: basic, the writing, again, the math competition, it can be on a rather intermediate level, and also attitude about kind of a work ethic issue.
Alarm clock stuff, learning how to use one and know that it's what it's for, that sort of thing.
And if your schedules come to work at 8 a.m., please be there at 8 a.m.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an attitudinal thing. So
that's really good, because you said exactly what I thought you would say, except the math surprises me a little. But thank you. I appreciate that.
Thank you, Senator Walker. President Pulliams, President Bernstein, thank you very much again for your testimony and for being here this evening.
Thank you.
Thank you
for the opportunity.
And I apologize, I have to leave to go to the Volunteers of America dinner tonight, where I know there'll be plenty of football experts with some coaching.
All right.
So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Take care.
Your friends have been a real success, and we've been honored to host you. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, now I'd like to call up Gary Sailors.
Sailors. Right.
I think I need a little remediation on the pronunciation here, and Mr. Ray Gunther. And I'm going to preface this with saying we've had such an incredible bit of testimony that we're really pushing it for time, so as much as you can be concise would be greatly appreciated. Yes, and then following this we will do, I'm going to go with the sign-up sheet. So. Following this testimony, the first, I'm going to call up two people, Wendy Kroger and Dennis Gilliam. So you'll be up next if you're still here.
Okay, I'll start. Thanks, Chair Polizio and members of the committee for this opportunity. My name is Ray Gunther. Just to give you a little bit of my background, I think it might help in why I'm here. I'm a retired senior manager from Intel Corporation, and here are my tenure there, I was responsible for corporate services, not only the Oregon site, but the Americas and globally. And prior to Intel, I worked in the natural resource traded sector for 10 plus years. So given all my past experience, I've been directly involved in developing and implementing education and workforce development programs for our workforce. Well, speaking for myself today, I have a long-standing, strong ties to the business sector and to the education community. As a member of the board of AOI and Oregon Business Council, and also currently a member of the Ready for School Leadership Panel, I'd like to make 2 points today. First, the government has it right when he talks about education as a continuum, and it must start with pre-kindergarten programs. The second point I want to make is that as a 1983 MBA alumni of PSU, I know that PSU is essential to the economy, the economic well-being of the metropolitan area and the state. I also must disclose that I am married to a school teacher, and my daughter is a product of the public education system in Oregon. My wife taught in the primary grades and levels for the last 20-plus years. While education has been a topic of discussion around our dinner table, it's also been a priority for me as a businessman. Whether it's in the whether it's students in the classroom or the workers at the work site, it's clear that education is a developmental process and must start early. I have been working to make full funding in HSSART a reality, and we can't stop there. I've also been involved with the development of the Oregon Business Plan and their initiative on education and workforce development, and which deserves serious consideration. And because it addresses the fundamental redesign and prioritization of investments in our pre-K through 20 education systems. As a business person, I've hired many high school graduates over the years, and the community colleges provide an open door and an opportunity to many of them to start on a four-year degree or prepare for a more skilled occupation. Underfunding those systems means that less Oregonians have opportunities. Oregon's four-year system is the foundation of economic strength, and cuts in that system not only have limited opportunities for Oregonians, but it has put Oregon's economy at risk. I still remember the discussion we had 10 years ago in the legislature about additional funding for engineering and computer science programs. As a result of that, we formed the Engineering, Technology, and Industry Council, which has been a big success story for the last 10 years. I go on record supporting the governor's approach, and I urge you to do so too. But funding alone isn't enough. While I know that Ways and Means does not deal with structural or broad policy issues, I urge you to work with your colleagues to begin to examine ways to reform the many education systems. The recommendation from the Oregon Business Plan Initiative and the Chalkboard Project is a beginning. I know tax reform is on the legislative agenda this session, and I want you to consider a full review of local and state funding of education. For example, K-12 and community colleges have access to property taxes for construction, and some want greater state support for these projects. Yet higher education goes to the voters for construction bonds and has to rely on private donors and state bonds. The education system should be equitable across the entire continuum. Now I want to get to my second point. Talk a little about Fulton State University. Fulton State is essential to our overall economic well-being in this region, not only this region, but the state. It's a place of excellence, as President Bernstein had mentioned earlier. And to speak on behalf of the business community, just from my personal experiences, being able to hire well-qualified candidates here locally is an economic savings to the companies, not just Intel, but other companies. For every employee that you have to recruit from out of state, you're looking at a minimum of $25,000 relocation cost. So there is an economic impact to every student that's not qualified here locally. They have to hire from outside the region. So from a business perspective, the more qualified candidates we have here locally through our local education system, the less cost it is to business to have to go hire from the outside or outside the area. From personal it also enables us. I can speak for a lot of my employees who started out as in low-skilled jobs, went through the community college system, got skilled jobs, and over a period of time tried to go back to higher education and get an advanced degree, either engineering or accounting or whatever the case may be. So if by having all these levels of education available to the workforce, provides a continuum for them to continue further their education. And on top of that, a lot of our employees go back for continuing education just to keep their skills up. For me personally, because PSU was here, I was able to get my MBA program up while I was continuing to work. I wasn't able to take time away from my family and go to school either in Eugene or Corvallis or either up in Seattle. So PSU was the only alternative I had at the time. And this is true of many students here in the Portland metropolitan area. You know, access is the number one priority for a lot of them. Either they have to work to support themselves or their families, and at the same time they're trying to get an education, or if some kids coming right out of high school can't afford to go off to college and live away from home. So from a cost standpoint, an access standpoint, it's very important that we have a strong university like PSU here in the local area that a lot of people who otherwise wouldn't be able to get a higher education degree have access. I think, if I looked at the a lot of discussion we've had within the business community, one of the other comments I hear about people, graduates coming out of PSU is that because of the fact they have to balance a workload with an academic load, plus in some cases raise a family, you get a much more mature graduate, a ready-to-work employee, and they hit the ground running. So that's another good strong reason why we need a strong university like PSU here. So I urge you to support full funding of all PSU students and the PSU capital projects. We need funding, as was mentioned earlier, for the Lincoln Building and the Science Building too, and also to fully realize the development of the PCAP building, which is the old waterworks building next door. In closing, I'd like to say that as a person who is responsible for building and maintaining many facilities within the corporation and providing a lot of support services within Intel, while trying to meet the diverse needs of many demanding business groups and employees, I know you have a tough job, and I appreciate, respect, the dedication you bring to this the services. So thank you again for the opportunity, and thank you for coming to PSU.
Thank you very much, Mr. Gunther. We have your written testimony, correct? Okay. Sure. So it's all yours, Gary. All right. I'm going to call you Gary.
That's great.
Can I?
Thank you,
call me Larry.
Mr. Chairman and committee, I'm very pleased to have an opportunity to represent 107,000 alumni from Portland State University. That's what our numbers are now. And I, as I go through this, my history goes back to the beginning of this campus. And so that's probably why I was chosen, because I'm one of the oldest people around that has dealt with this university. My name is Gary Salyers.
Mr. Salyers, you just said it. Okay. We just want to make sure for the record.
My name is Gary Salyers. I live in Milwaukee. I'd like to welcome you to my university. I started here as a student in January of 1953. And the old Lincoln High School, at that time, was called Old Main. And it was the main building on campus. It was part of the Portland Extension Center. The Portland Extension Center had moved to this location from the Oregon Shipyard in the fall of 52. And so I came in just after they came here. A student could take 2 years of credits here and then transfer to a university somewhere. But when I was a junior, the junior year was added. And when I was a senior, the senior year was added. And so I was able to, and Portland State was born, and I was finished my degree in summer session of 1956. And I started teaching in Milwaukee that fall at the sixth grade level. I missed graduating with the very first class here by 9 credit hours because I went to work full-time over that summer. Got married in September and only took 9 credit hours at night. So I ended up 9 credit hours short at the end of of June, and I went to summer session and did graduate, was able to walk with the class of 1957, second graduating class. I was the first person in my immediate family to graduate from college. My dad was a skilled lumber worker, and many of my uncles were also mill workers. I graduated from a small high school in the town of Klaskanai, and I thought I would follow my family to the sawmill. But two of my high school teachers encouraged me to try college, and the football coach that I had at that high school told me that he thought he could get me a small scholarship to play football at Oregon College of Education. I told him I thought I'd work in the mill like my dad. So I got a job for the summer in the sawmill, pulling lumber on the planer chain. My parents moved to Portland during that summer, where my dad had found a better job working in the lumber business, but traveling around the Northwest inspecting lumber. Coincidentally, he retired from Army Corps of Engineers as an inspector of piling and big timbers and material that was used in making docks, and was involved with the Army Engineers during the end of the Korean War and during the Vietnam War, when all of the docks were being built in the Navy. So he had a very skilled job. The mill workers that I worked with encouraged all of us young guys to go to college so we would not end up in what they thought was a career with few options. I finally decided to call my football coach and to see what he could do, and he lined me up at OCD, and I played football and attended my first term of college. School was okay, grades were okay, but I crushed the disc in my lower back, and my football days were over. So it was time to move back home with the parents who had moved to Portland. Money was not there for me to go to private school, so my option was to go to Portland Extension Center and hope to transfer after my 2 years. But I really began to enjoy college, and I ran for senator in student government, and I was elected. So I was with the student leaders that went to Salem to testify at the legislature, similar to this, with the request that Portland Extension Center could add the junior and senior years so that we could graduate from Portland State College. And along with many Portland area legislators, we were very happy when we really did have a four-year college, even if the number of fields of study were limited. At that time, it was education, general studies, and social work. My bachelor's degree was in elementary education, and after a couple years, I was back taking night classes to work on a master's degree. At that time, Portland State did not offer a master's program, so I transferred my credits to Senator Walker, the University of Oregon, where I also studied for two summer sessions, and I received my master's in education degree in 1962. I applied for an elementary principal's position and was selected to be the principal at Happy Valley School starting in August of 1962. I had the opportunity to be the principal at three additional elementary schools during my 29 years in that role in the North Clackamas School District. With the 6 years I taught and the years as a principal, I retired in 1991 after a great career of helping thousands of children in their first years of school. I've had the opportunity to serve in a leadership position in many educational associations. I've been on board of directors at the state and national level. I served as president of the Oregon Elementary School Principals Association, the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, and the National Association of Elementary School Principals. I had the opportunity to meet with several national leaders during my time as president of the National Association of Elementary School Principals. All of these opportunities began here at Old Main. I am pleased that you are interested in making a reinvestment in this facility and to upgrade the science building too. They really need the help, and they are very vital to this university. With pride, I have watched Portland State University grow and play an expanded role in this community as well as in the state. And I have continued to be involved here on this campus by volunteering on several committees and through involving my sons and now my grandchildren at sporting events. It pays off, as both my oldest son and my oldest grandson are graduates of Portland State University. So we are now a three-generation Portland State family. So thank you for allowing me to share my story with you. That's one of 107,000. And without Portland Extension Center and Portland State College being here and available to me, it would not have happened this way. So I owe the school a large amount of thanks for the opportunities that were open for me and my family.
Thank you very much, Mr. Salyers. Are you applying for the football coaching position?
No, but I did coach football, but they were sixth graders, and we were undefeated for several years. Oh.
And are you telling this committee that you're the son of a mill worker?
That's true.
Didn't I? Is that 2004? John Edwards, don't you remember? That was his line. Okay, too much political junkie. That was his line. Are there any questions or comments?
Just a very quick comment. Mr. Salyers, yours is an incredible Oregon success story, and I really appreciate you sharing this with us. It really puts a human face on the kinds of things that we're working for.
Well, we certainly appreciate what you do.
Well, I want to thank you, Mr. Salyers, Mr. Gunther. Greatly appreciate it. Okay, so with that, I'm already in trouble with this committee because last night I kept them an hour longer than our scheduled meeting. So it was a good meeting, but it was an hour longer, than so I feel bad. So I beg the committee's indulgence. If we can be maybe 7:15.
That's as late as I can.
I know, because I know you have dinner reservations.
Yeah.
So we stimulate the local economy. So I'm going to ask that people are brief and concise and to the point. I want you to make your point, but please be aware just because we have about 15 or so people. And I'm going to call folks up in groups as we can.
So everybody gets 1 minute?
I think we have less than 15, so we'll do it. All right. So first, Wendy Kroger and Dennis Gilliam. And then sort of on deck, I think we have, I don't know if they're necessarily faculty members, but on faculty issues, Brooke Jacobson, Kelly Cowan, and Stephanie, it looks like Blackman? I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. Mr. Gilliam.
I'm Dennis Gilliam. I am the Executive Vice President of Bob's Red Mill Natural Foods in Milwaukee, Oregon. We manufacture whole grain foods. In addition to my duties in sales and marketing and public relations, I have a hat I really, really enjoy putting on, and that's new product development. I'm keenly aware that there is a facility here on NATO Parkway in Portland called the Food Innovation Center, and that facility is an experimental station of the Extension Service. But you know, in my mind's eye, I don't view that place as an experimental station at all. I view it, and I believe quite properly, as an innovation and fulfillment station. And I'd like to tell you why. For a small company of 145, we have achieved quite an enviable position in the grocery and natural food world, of having our products on nearly every grocery and natural food store shelf in the U.S. and Canada. And being in charge of new products, I know the importance of innovating new products. It really helps build sizzle into our sales. There's two ways I can innovate, and that's seat of the pants and doing it right. I tried the seat of the pants. I had a couple of failures. You don't need to hear about those. I want to forget those. 2 years ago, we saw the opportunity coming. Whole grain foods has always been who we are, but the world now recognizes that whole grain foods is the best eating lifestyle you can imagine when coupled with fruits and vegetables. We advertised that we have whole grain fruits for every meal of the day, but we found we were deficient in the dessert category, and we thought, well, why don't we innovate some new cake mixes that make them whole grain? We took that to the Food Innovation Center, Sarah Massoni and her people. We said, you must use Oregon soft white wheat, a whole wheat pastry flour, most of which comes from Gillam and other counties, I believe Umatilla being one of those. But beyond that, we know how to make the products, but we don't know how to blend products. We don't know how to make them taste good. We don't know how to bring good moisture. We don't know how to hit the right price point. And hit a dynamic flavor profile. Please help us make it work. I'm telling you, they helped us hit a home run. We've introduced those cake mixes about a year and a half ago. They are flying out off of our manufacturing lines. Then we took them our five organic pancake and waffle mixes, and they did the same with those. They styled them with ingredients that were all whole grain. They helped us roll them out. Again, we'll be showing those for the first time at the largest natural product show in the world, March 9, 10, and 11, down in Anaheim, California. So that's our rollout for this year. There's a lot of sizzle in that.
Mr. Gillian, we're starving, so you gotta. You can't talk too much more about the cake.
I won't.
All right.
All right. There's a whole lot of Oregon in every bag, I'm telling you. And there's a whole lot of Southlake wheat in every bag. And there's a whole lot of Food Innovation Center in every bag. Without that Food Innovation Center there, and they consistently meet our needs. They meet them on time and on budget. And I'm thankful for their. I need them. I use them.
Thank you very, very much. Ms. Cork?
Good evening. And I want to say thank you so much for being here and for coming out and hearing us. And I have learned so much this evening. I've really enjoyed what I've heard from other people. And I thoroughly enjoyed my cohorts. I haven't met this gentleman. I borrowed his pencil, but I've tried his products, and yes. Anyway, I wanted to let you know that I am probably a good example of what happened when you invested in education and higher education in this state in the 1960s. That's not the reason I came here this evening, but I wanted to just very quickly say that, because we do build for the future. We look at models. We say what will happen. We hope it will work. I went to the University of Oregon. I was a single mom. I was not one of those people that looked like I had any kinds of possible future at all. I became the first person in my family to graduate from college. The University of Oregon was absolutely wonderful to me and turned my life around. We used to laugh and say that there's one less seat in Austin Stadium because it paid for my last term of school. But because of that, I never had to go on welfare again. I contributed for the rest of my life as a professional in this country, working in community service and what I wanted to do. I have a daughter now who has a master's degree. My brother has a master's degree. None of these things would have happened without that first hint of help and success. So that having been said, for higher education in this state, I was an Oregonian who wasn't going to get anywhere. And I got an investment from the University of Oregon, and I have tried to pay it back ever since. So, that being said, the reason I came here this evening was to support the Oregon Board of Higher Education's recommended $15 million budget for what they call statewide public service programs. This is their first proposed increase for the Extension Service, the Ag Experiment Station, and the Forest Research Lab since 1999, and I would point out that that is last century. In terms of my personal experience, I grew up in 4-H in Hood River. I went from Hood River to Eugene, obviously, lived my life, but for the last 13 years I've been a certified master gardener. And as that, I've also been working with what's called the Extension Citizens Advisory Network. I'm Washington County's representative on that body. I contribute probably 1,000 hours a year to Extension programs as a volunteer. But to put that in perspective, I'm only one of about 23,000 other volunteers who've contributed almost 1.5 million hours in the last year. So, you know, I'm just one of many, but I feel so honored to have been able to do that. I've come here this evening with two concerns. One is bridging the urban-rural divide in Oregon and how we can continue to make that happen, and also to protect and sustain and enhance the research-based information that we still make available through Extension and OSU primarily to the public. Regarding the budget proposal, the Extension now has 19 fewer agents than they did in 2001. And if we can just get that recommended budget passed, we'll bring it back up to where they were in 2001. The governor's budget is $5 million for all of the three statewide public service programs. Program capacity is seriously eroding. The rubber band is stretched and it's snapping. As a master gardener, I can tell you the plants eventually die if they're starved. And I think that's what's happening to the Extension Service and Ag Research and Forestry Research in this state. They're sharing agents over many counties. It's not serving anyone well. We can't get good people in the jobs. I think you've heard that before, failed searches, because people take one look and say, you want me to what? We are starving things like the National Clonal Germplasm Repository, and if you want to know about, more about that, I can tell you, but it's a bad thing to starve it. I think spending an inordinate amount of time trying to find new money and new partners and make through new collaborations is very creative, but I really think we should be allowing these three public service agencies the chance to do their mission, not spend time having to raise money, so they just can stay in existence. We benefit greatly from their programs and their research, and we need to pay for them.
Ms. Kroger, can you give me your bottom line so we can...
Yes, the bottom line is please support the Oregon Board of Higher Education's recommended budget of $15 million instead of the governor's budget, I'm sad to say, is only $5 million. So, thank you.
Thank you both very much. Sorry to cut it short, but...
Mr. Chair?
Yes?
Just very quickly.
Yes, and meanwhile,
Brooke Johnson, Brooke Jacobson. I appreciate you very much what you both have had to say. I'll come home to haunt you on this when it gets to that budget.
I think you have a supporter here. Okay, Brooke Jacobson, Kelly Cowan, and Stephanie Blackman, and it looks like we only have two chairs.
Stephanie's not here. Well, while they're getting settled, Mr. Chair, the statewides are an incredibly important program, not only to the rural areas of the state, but to the urban areas of the state, and they have a lot of challenges this time because there's a large federal funding component to the program that's in jeopardy. So I think that as we move through these discussions, that's something that we're going to have to be talking about.
Thank you, Representative. And then just on deck, so to speak, I have David Adelsheim and Brad Dreyfus, it looks like, and John
Sipley.
Yeah. Yeah, and I would just say, if you have written testimony, that's great. We will keep it. We will read it. It's really preferable, as much as you can, just talk to us, especially because the hour is late.
Thank you, and thank you for your patience. My name is Brooke Jacobson. I hold a PhD in film studies from the University of Southern California, and I teach film as an adjunct faculty member in the Department of Communication Studies at PSU. And I might also say I am a PSU from... I entered here in 59, quite a long time ago, so... And I'm also president of the Portland State University Faculty Association, Local 3571 of the American Federation of Teachers. Our local represents approximately 1,000 part-time faculty who teach at PSU in any given year. And we understand from the state board's figures on this that about 51.1% of OUS faculty are part-time. We think it's actually much higher by now. That was a 2005 figure. Last month, our local did a survey of members to get a better sense of who they are and what their experience is with teaching, and I wanted to share some of those findings with you. Our part-time unit includes a number of people who hold full-time professional jobs in the community and bring their expertise into the classroom. And that's a wonderful asset for the school. But a larger portion of that part-time faculty consists of people with full academic qualifications who see the university as their primary employer and are chronically underemployed and underpaid. Many of these part-timers have worked at PSU, as I have for a number of years, 10 to 15 years, in my case it's 17 now, as part-time temporary employees with no health care, no pay or pay that's just a fraction of what full-time faculty receive for teaching the same number of credit hours. These are people who should be hired in full-time positions so they can actually fulfill their professional mission, and they should be fairly compensated for the work that they do, what they bring to the university and to the curriculum here. Our union has tried with some success to remedy the job security issue. by requiring that after people have taught for a couple of years that they get a contract that specifies a certain number of courses throughout the year that they'll be teaching so that they can plan, because many of these people have to teach at multiple campuses, move around, and juggle these various jobs. And they need that, you know, an outline of where they're going to be and when. Many departments continue to simply hire term by term. And this is a practice that makes it very, very difficult for part-timers. Often people are called a week or two before a class is to begin, asked to teach, and in that way they don't have sufficient time to prepare, to do their best work, and often it conflicts with something else they're doing, they have to turn them down. This isn't fair to students, we feel, who are paying ever higher tuition and fees and are simply shortchanged because their professors can't be really available to them full-time. It's bad enough that the students are working full-time and juggling their families and responsibilities. So we feel that this is really a false economy, this use of extended use of part-time faculty, and something that we would like the legislature to look at and to consider carefully and support legislation to remedy.
Yeah, and Ms. Jacobson, I can just tell you, even in, not only in this committee have we discussed this, the part-time, full-time ratio, also in Senator Walker's committee. So this is something that we're quite aware of, and your union AFT has a very strong presence, so it's something on a lot of people's minds, so we appreciate it. So if you could kind of wrap it, that's kind of your we need to really work on that ratio, full-time, part-time ratio, is that's your...
And a system of, it's like an apartheid system, because those part-timers are not involved with their colleagues in planning the curriculum, developing policies, dealing with student issues.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, good evening, Chairman and committee members. My name is Kelly Cowan, and I'm also a member of the PSU Faculty Association. I actually just recently joined. And I'm a part-time instructor in the School of Business. So I teach marketing research, I teach basic marketing, and in addition to that, I'm also a PhD student, so I kind of wear a couple of hats right now. I'm actually in the system science program, which I believe one of the speakers mentioned previously, Dr. Wakeland, happens to be my advisor, so do kind of similar computer modeling to what he was talking about. I wanted to make a couple of points just to bring to your attention some issues affecting part-time faculty. As Brooke has mentioned, a number of issues come up for part-time faculty. First of all, I want to make sure that people are aware of just how much teaching that we're doing. You mentioned a faculty ratio of 51%, or part-time, full-time, but in actual fact, many departments have the majority, if not the overwhelming majority of classes, taught by part-time instructors. And this is because different part-time instructors teach in different terms. And when you add this all up, certain schools like the business department or university studies actually end up being heavily loaded with part-time instructors. So we actually represent a very considerable amount of the courses being taught. And just to bring up some of our concerns, we end up having to do a significant amount of preparation time each time that we have a class to teach. So, for instance, as I first came up here, I actually moved from New Mexico, so I can echo some of your comments about some things that are going well there and things that I'd hope to see similarly implemented here. When I first moved up here, I was asked to teach a class, and I was given very little notice. So I had to quickly prepare to teach that class. Now, fortunately, I was able to continue teaching that class the next term. There was actually a situation where one of the other full-time instructors needed surgery. I had to take over his class, so I did that. But the following term, I wasn't able to continue that class. So you have to, and he continued, of course, to be out long-term. But the point is that it actually takes a very significant amount of time to get a class started the first time. When you have to prepare a class that you haven't taught before, it probably takes 2 to 3 times the normal amount of time that it would to just ordinarily teach that class. So if we're asked to teach classes, we really need to know that we're going to be able to continue teaching those classes in the future. And so that's one very big issue. And I'd also just like to sort of wrap up by voicing support for the faculty and college excellence bill, HB 2578. The main thing that we support here is just the idea of coupling the compensation that part-time instructors get to some fraction of what the full-time instructors get. Currently, if you look at the amount of compensation given to full-time instructors compared to part-time instructors, we receive a tiny fraction. In some cases, it might be 3 to 4 times less for the same class that we teach. So I would voice strong support for that. And those are my comments.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I should just let you know, I teach at Portland Community College, and again, we're struggling with this issue. We have probably now, we do it more part-time, and and it's not a question of people not being qualified. They're often very qualified, and they're extraordinarily dedicated, but it's very difficult. So the equity question is huge. So thank you both very much.
Thank you.
And now, Mr. Adelsheim, Mr. Dreyfus, and John, pronounce your name for me.
Sibley.
Okay, and again, please have a seat. And if somebody says something that you were already going to say, we've heard it. We appreciate it. And again, sorry, I just.
My name is Brad Dreyfus. I'm currently a fifth-year medical student and public health student at OHSU and president of the OHSU Student Council. So I come as a student as well as trying to represent the rest of the OHSU students. I want to thank you very much for this opportunity to speak with you a bit, and I'll try and keep this to bullet points. First of all, despite being a grad student, I am married to a public school teacher, teaches fourth grade. So definitely get the perspective of the aqueduct, I think was the metaphor, and the need to support that whole range of programming and make sure the pipeline stays intact. I want to acknowledge and express our appreciation for the governor's budget and the support it's given back to OHSU, and would like to see that followed through to the largest extent it can. I'd also like to echo my fellow student leaders' sentiments from PSU and Mount Hood Community College with regard to the increasing student costs, both tuition, which OHSU, it's increased 50 to 60% in the last 5 years, but also the increases in student fees, which have gone up approximately 300% in that same time. Our debts are sizable. Personally, I think I'll have over $240,000 in debt. Some of which will be around 8%, and some of which will be around 4 or 5%. And I think a lot of us would be lying if we said it did not influence our choices of specialty. One of the big issues for the state is lack of providers at all levels, and nursing has been highlighted in the past. There's also physicians, it's ancillary staff, it's dentists, the whole gamut, and the debt load. Students looking into different careers who are promising, a lot of students will not choose going into medicine because of that huge mountain of debt you're trying to figure out how you're going to pay off. And for a lot of us in student leadership, one of our big concerns is a lack of underrepresented minorities and not being able to get a diverse student body, partly because the pipeline in Oregon needs help, but also because the financial implications of what that would include. Some of the issues on the federal level also affect us, federal caps. I've hit my cap and was trying to figure out how to pay for my last semester of school. So funding is a major issue. AHEC and bridging that gap between the rural and the urban in the state is a huge issue, and it's a large issue when it comes to funding. The governor's budget, my understanding is it's dependent on 4 tax increases in a state that does not look favorably upon tax increases. We need to do more PR on what those tax dollars will actually buy and what that takes back to the rural areas. And OHSU has made a huge move in the last year, and it will continue to reach out to the rural areas, and we hope that we can really work with the legislature to bring that to fruition in the form of funds. And I'll cut it short there. Thank you all very much.
Thank you very much. And your timing is excellent, because I think we do the OHSU budget starting on Monday, right?
Again, see you again.
Yeah, and you'll be too busy to come down, but we've listened, so thank you.
Chair Galizio and members of the subcommittee, thanks for letting me have a moment. I'm Dave Adelsheim, President of Adelsheim Vineyard in Newburgh. We've been around for a while, actually pretty quickly after I graduated from Portland State. I started the winery. But that's not why I'm here to talk today. Since the founding, or refounding, if you will, of the Oregon wine industry in the 1960s, OSU, and particularly the Extension Service, the Experiment Station and the Extension Service have been our partners in getting us to where we are today. I'm sure you know that the Oregon wine industry contributes $1.2 billion to Oregon's economy every year. Much of that has to do with the advances that we've been able to make because none of our companies are big enough to do R&D on our own. So we're entirely dependent on a land-grant university and on federal funding and on state funding to do that research. And it's because we've had that over the years. We've got methods of approximating what our crop level can be so we can keep concentrations of our wine high. We have new bacteria that we've been able to use to do the secondary fermentations that were developed at OSU. OSU put on the first cool climate grape growing and winemaking conference in 1984. It takes place every 4 years and comes back to the Northwest 2 years from now. I can go on and on about innovations that OSU has helped us with, but it's critically those parts of the statewide public services agencies that are housed at OSU that have made that contribution and that we're reliant on. We'll be back to you later this year to talk about a new step that we plan to take with OSU to create a new paradigm of research. It'll be an institute of an OSU wine institute that will bring faculty together and focus both research and extension so that the research that's done can be communicated back to the industry and we can continue to grow. At this point, we're somewhere in excess of 500 brands. We have more than 500 independent growers. So 1,000 different entities, that make up our industry. We are the kind of industry that Oregon wants. We don't pollute. We have the highest level of third-party certification of sustainability of any wine grower state in the country. And we obviously have wide recognition all over the world. Thanks for letting me speak. Do please support an increase in the public services agencies at OSU so that we can continue to depend on them.
Thank you very much, Mr. Wilson. Appreciate it.
Chair Galizio, members of the committee, good evening. My name is John Sibley, and I am employed here at Portland State University Facilities and Planning Department as a refrigeration mechanist. I've been here at PSU since 1983 and experienced many of the changes PSUs have to survive. PSU started out with returning World War II veterans and had to move to higher ground after the Danforth flooding. We continue to serve veterans, and PSU continues to flood. When the Columbia River ran us out of the present campus, the flooding did not stop. We now flood when it rains due to failed roofs. We flood when old and inferior water piping fails, and my least favorite, our overtaxed and failing sewer lines. You have heard about the millions of dollars needed to repair multiple maintenance problems and capital needs at PSU. The millions needed are numbers beyond me, but the lack of investment is my everyday reality. The problem at PSU is not just the flooding. It includes the deterioration of the infrastructure and the crew's inability to keep things working. The classified staff have pointed out problems to our managers. Our managers have come up with plans and costs. President Bernstein has presented priorities and specifics to you. Whatever the final budget is, please give us the ability to spend the money wisely. Our crew has more gray hair and in some cases less hair than when I started in 1983. We need to administer these monies effectively and hope to train our replacements at the same time. Thank you for your time, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Sure you're not a professor of poetry as well on the side there?
I'm just a tradesman.
Yeah, just a tradesman. Thank you very much. Very compelling testimony.
Thank you for your attention. Appreciate it.
Okay, Katie Campbell, Monique Peterson, Donna Harris, and Sean Larkin.
I've got the staff in the back there.
And who's on deck?
Nobody's on deck. This is it. This is it.
Okay.
And my committee is still... Senator Walker, I apologize. She had to go.
Good evening, Chair Glazio, the rest of the members of the committee. Thank you so much for being here to listen to us tonight. My name is Monique Peterson. I am a senior at Portland State studying political science, and I'm the communications director for the student government here, the Associated Students of Portland State University. I'm here to talk very briefly about tuition equity, which you may know of as House Bill 2705, and why I think the Oregon legislature should make sure that it's passed. Tuition equity is a concept that would extend in-state tuition rates to all Oregonian students, regardless of immigration status, if they meet a few requirements. Students have to have attended an Oregon high school for at least 3 years. Students have to have obtained a diploma or equivalent from an Oregon institution, and they must currently be working towards resident status. There are countless reasons why tuition equity is the right natural step for Oregon to take, but I'll just give you mine. 23 years ago, my parents moved to the U.S. when Fordham University in New York offered my father a scholarship to complete his Ph.D. There was a long history of higher education in my family, and of course my parents jumped at the chance for advancement. At this time, my older brother, Lindsay, was one year old and had been born in France and shortly moved to South Africa. My parents obtained visas, moved to the U.S., and found jobs teaching shortly after I was born here and four brothers after me. We grew up in New York, then moved to Oregon when I was in high school, and my younger brothers and parents now live in California. What I would like to tell you is what became of my older brother, Lindsay. After graduating from Century High School in Hillsboro, Oregon, my parents were faced with the dilemma of where to send him to college. Having been born in France, he was not eligible for financial aid in the U.S. or in-state tuition at a public university. After a year or so of attending a cheap, unprestigious community college in Northern California, where my parents moved a little while after, it was time to move to a four-year college where he could obtain a degree. The problem was that I was now in college as well, and my parents would have had a hard time making tuition payments for two children. Now that my brother was no longer a minor, he would also have to obtain his own visa to stay in the United States, but could do so only if my parents could afford to send him to a public university where he could apply for a student visa. Since the tuition has skyrocketed for out-of-state students or for students who don't have in-state tuition, Lizzie had no choice but to return to South Africa to attend school where tuition would be affordable. He had only been there once before, had spent his entire life in the U.S. He's American as apple pie, as they say. But he now has to live in a country where he doesn't know the language, the people, or the culture. And after leaving the U.S. in a post-9/11 world, he has failed to obtain the appropriate visa to return. My mother has not been able to see her oldest son in 3 years, and I did not get to attend university with my older brother as we had been planning to do our whole lives. Tuition equity would have made a huge difference to my family. I'm doing well at Portland State University. I love this school, and I love this city, and I've dedicated my life to serving this community. I do, however, miss my brother very much, and sharing college life with him would have been wonderful. It's probably too late for him, but tuition equity is right on time for many high school seniors considering higher education, and I encourage you to keep it on your radar and look for it when it comes up to a vote, and I would encourage you to vote for its passage. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Ms. Peterson. Ms. Campbell.
Yes, Chair Galizio, members of the committee, thank you so much for coming here today and bearing witness to our testimony. This is the first time that I have ever testified, and I was worried. I was actually really embarrassed coming out here and, like, telling my personal story, but as my good friend, told me that I should not be the one who's embarrassed.
I need you to say your name.
Katie Campbell. My name is Katie Campbell. I should not be embarrassed. It should be Oregon who is embarrassed for disinvesting the most
in higher education in the entire nation for the past 10 years. With that said, my name is Katie Campbell. I live in Portland and I attend Portland State. I'm here to advocate on the importance, on the absolute need for the Oregon Opportunity Grant and the Shared Responsibility Model. And I hope that what I have to say will have some kind of an impact, because the citizens of Oregon have very dearly felt the impact of the cost of higher education, and it's time for our voices to be heard. Let me start by saying really quickly that the Oregon Opportunity Grant is Oregon's only need-based aid. It covers about 11% of the cost of tuition. Why 11% for all those who qualify regardless of their financial differences? I don't know, and personally, no one has ever explained that to me. In a time where students have to work almost 60 hours a week to afford to go to college, as opposed to my parents who could work their way through college based on a 20-hour work week, a change in the cost of higher education is severely needed. The governor stepped up to this task, and with universities, colleges, and students, and many others across Oregon, they created the Shared Responsibility Model, which would, for the first time, restore the Oregon Opportunity Grant to its original mission by allowing a student to work their way through college based on a reasonable hour work week. The Shared Responsibility Model would increase much needed need-based aid, and I'd like to share a little bit about the reality of having to work your way through college by describing what I have to do to pursue this costly college degree. Most mornings, I'm awake before the sun rises. I reheat yesterday's leftover coffee, and I sweeten it with packets of sugar and non-dairy creamer that I have heisted from the Starbucks condiment stand. I'm responsible for taking care of my younger siblings and providing food for them, and it's not uncommon to find me watering down their milk to cut costs, wrapping them up in sweaters and layers of socks instead of using the heater, reading by flashlight to slave on electricity. Ever since my little brother and sister came to live with me after our parents died, I have worried every single day about the repercussions of feeding them low-quality food. I wish I could provide them with only the best, as anyone who loves their family would, but I have to make sacrifices. I could work full-time at a minimum wage-paying job and be able to afford a few luxuries, or I could work a full-time job, that same full-time job, and take out a bunch of loans so I can get an education to better my life and therefore my little brother and sisters as well, during which time I just have to skimp on the finer things of life, such as milk-free from hormones, pesticide-free vegetables, and disease-free meat. Even though I work full-time, even though I have taken out loan after loan to help pay for the rising cost of higher education, even though I get financial aid and the Oregon Opportunity Grant, I still have to stand in line at the welfare office for food stamps with the eyes of every judging person boring into me, as if I'm here because I want to be, like I'm a failure in society because I'm struggling to get an education and can't afford basic necessities on a good day. I cut corners by researching materials online instead of buying costly textbooks, by snagging toilet paper out of rolls out of public restrooms, taking leftovers from random events at Portland State to feed my family. I wash my clothes by hand and I hang them up to dry to conserve energy. This is the state that I am reduced to, a hardworking, taxpaying Oregonian, hoping for a better future, standing in line at the local shelter for a free food box because I just can't afford the ridiculously high cost of an education in Oregon. My brother moved down to California because he couldn't afford tuition here. After living there for a year, he not only got in-state tuition at $22 a unit, but eventually he received what's called the Board of Governors waive, or a BOG, which it's a program that waives all tuition costs for those who qualify. It makes me wonder how many other states like California invest in higher education, and why is Oregon dead last in the nation for post-secondary education funding? All I ask from all of the sacrifice that I make, all the worry from my younger siblings, all the risk that I put my future into, all I ask of this is that the Oregon legislator go through the efforts that I must make to value an educated society. The increased grant size of the Oregon Opportunity Grant with a shared responsibility model wouldn't solve all of my hardships, but would make sure that I and the thousands of other struggling students out there can feed their families and finally finish our degrees. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
You're both very courageous, and the committee thanks you for coming to testify. And this absolutely has an impact, and hopefully we can do right by you and the other citizens of Oregon. So thank you.
There are a few other students who really wanted to testify but couldn't because of time constraints, and I'd like to leave you with their written testimony.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you very much. Okay, are you
Sean Larkin?
And I think you're it. You're the last one. Okay, Mr. Larkin.
Cool. Hi. Thank you very much. I'd like to thank you all very much for extending the time period to allow me this chance to speak. As I said, my name is Sean Larkin. I am 19 years old, and I'm currently a sophomore at Portland State. And to be blunt, I wouldn't be standing before this committee were it not for need-based grants. This is hard for me to say because I don't really talk about it, but I was born into poverty. My mom, on her own, raised me and my brother with food stamps and welfare when the government finally gave it to us. And despite whatever talents and abilities my teachers praised me and my brother for having, I never thought we could go to college. We just didn't have the money. We didn't have it. Our parents didn't have it. It just didn't seem like an option. But a friend just told me to fill out the FAFSA my senior year, and I was like, okay, it's not going to hurt. And to my surprise, my government wanted to give me money to go to school, and this was a novel concept to me. But I didn't ask any questions, and I took the opportunity, and I cannot tell you how important college has been to me as a person. The amount of, I mean, intellectual growth, spiritual growth, you know, emotional growth, just how much of a better person I've become. And when I think if I hadn't had that opportunity, what my life would have been like, even now, it's very different. And because I came out of this low-income background, something I've been very passionate about is advocacy and social change for those that are in disadvantage. And that's why I'm before this community, because I wanted to tell my story about what these grants did for me. So I got the chance to go to college, and I got involved in student work and activism and advocacy. But something very scary that really frightened me happened at the beginning of this year. My federal grants were substantially cut as a result of the federal cuts to higher education, and I had a very, very stark reality to face, and that was either to end my student work, just completely stop advocating for students, all the so important things that I was doing for students in the community and in Portland, just stop that so I could earn more money, so I could sustain a living, or challenge myself and really live on edge. And I've been doing that for the past 6 months, and it has been the most difficult thing I've ever had to do. And unfortunately, a week ago today, I had to resign as my post as chapter chair of a student group on campus, and I'm currently in the job market. It got to the point where I was cutting rent checks, knowing I was going to overdraft, knowing the bank would charge me an overdraft fee, but I had no choice. I had to pay for food, I had to pay for rent. And that's really, to me, what these grants are all about, is we as a society are acknowledging that certain individuals are born into circumstances in which they don't have the opportunity normally to advance themselves as a person, regardless of what skills and abilities they have. We're saying as a society, no, these people deserve their chance at bettering themselves. We are going to provide for them to have an education. And in my opinion, there is no better thing to invest in than education. I'm sure all of you are very aware of the importance of education. But I think that now we're at a crossroads where we need to say, do we want our populace to be educated? It's a yes or no question. And if it's yes, then the government needs to help, because that's what the government is here for. And Oregon has actually taken a leadership role in environmentalism with all the current government's work. And I don't see why we shouldn't take a lead in education, because though it is really easy to say, instead of all these scholarships, let's go build a bridge in Bend. Look at how many people will be helped by that bridge. But you have to weigh that against how important society educated citizens are. And I just really want to stress that. And I'd like to thank you again for your time. And I strongly, strongly recommend increasing funds to higher education. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Can
Margaret.
I just I very much appreciate your comments, and I very much appreciate you telling us your story. And I also very much appreciate you making the decision to get a job and stay in school, because I think a part of this is what you said without saying it, and that's your desire to get an education. And without that spark inside of yourself, all of the work that we do to provide those opportunities are not going to take hold. So it's the spirit that you have inside of you to get an education that's so critical.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Morgan. Thank you very much. Committee members have any closing comments they'd like to make now that I've kept them? No. Okay, I want to thank everyone. I want to thank Eric Sorensen, who's in the back, from Legislative Fiscal. I want to thank Steve Bender, who for the second night in a row is... Well, actually, no, your colleague is there. You were there. Anyway, thank you, Portland State University, and the public hearing is now adjourned. Thank you.
Oh, my gosh.